It's not like it's a competition that's on again next year. You have to wait a full Olympic cycle to go again. Realistically, most of the team aren't going to be here again for the next Olympics, so it's like it's do or die.
For the best Olympics coverage, subscribe to the OTB Highlights podcast feed on the OTB Sports app now.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
7:30 on this Tuesday morning. You're welcome along to OTB AM. We are with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. And the big news overnight is that Ireland have earned another medal at the Olympic Games. Kelly Harrington's quarterfinal wins means she is guaranteed at least a bronze medal in Tokyo. She will fight See Son Dee of Thailand for at least a silver medal on Thursday morning. See Son Dee had a brilliant win against Dubois of Great Britain earlier this morning, right after Kelly Harrington's fight. We're going to have plenty of reaction to all of that, as well as reaction to everything else that happened this morning in Tokyo, including what was an absolutely bonkers 400 metre hurdles final, one of the greatest races in athletics history. We'd love to hear from you. You can drop us a tweet at Off the Ball or comment on the YouTube stream. We're going to have plenty of GAA, Formula One, rugby and the latest in the Harry Kane transfer saga over the next little while. And it will be all in the company of Shane Hannan, who is still reeling from yet another narrow defeat for Monaghan and Croke Park. Shane, commiserations and a very good morning to you.
Morning, Owen. I was hoping we'd go the next couple of hours without mentioning that, but you've started off with it, so thanks for that.
We are going to be bringing you Shane's exclusive reaction to Monaghan's defeat in the performance rankings. We're also going to be getting stuck into a brilliant morning for Kelly Harrington in there as well, and that's where we're going to talk about Harry Kane and the Formula One as well. But we should start this morning, Shane, with one of the most incredible races we've ever seen in track and field, in athletics. Carson Warholm breaking his own world record in the process of winning the 400-metre hurdles gold medal. This was, of course, the final that Tom Barr perhaps should have been in. His time was fast enough to qualify. He just got stuck with a pretty unlucky draw on Sunday afternoon. And what resulted was just this crazy pace. People are talking about the speed of the track, the speed of the shoes. We're going to have Kyle Dennehy of the Irish Independent and of other publications with us a little bit later on this morning to tell us why this has happened. But what we saw this morning was one of the most intense athletes I've ever seen performing at his absolute peak. I'm talking about Roy Keane and Michael Jordan all rolled up into one. I would love to see the bruises on this guy's body from how many times he slaps himself in the build-up to a race. He's almost parody-like in his intensity. Like it goes beyond the point of intensity to a comical level, in my opinion, but it is absolutely working, whatever he's doing. He is one of the finest people we've seen on the track over the course of the last few days.
I mean, I just love the confidence. The confidence and the look on his face when he looks up and sees that he's shattered the world record. Like, athletics nerds will tell you that, you know, breaking a world record is the pinnacle of any athlete's career. But to do it by 0.8 seconds, I mean, to shatter it in the manner that he did in the biggest race of his life was just incredible. And this was the race that a lot of people were looking forward to at the Olympics this year once the track and field event started. And geez, did it live up to its billing. I mean, sometimes you get races that are really, really hyped up and they just do not deliver. But this one was quite incredible. Cathal Dennehy, like you mentioned, we'll be speaking to him a little bit later on. He summed it up quite nicely in a tweet. He said, "I've seen the Grand Canyon, Iguazu Falls, Messi hitting a wonder strike in the Nou Camp, and I've never seen anything that comes close to that 400-metre hurdles final." Like, as you said, probably the best race in athletics history, which sounds like hyperbole, but really, it's not.
Yeah, like, I mean, the thing about this is that there was this moment after about 300 metres when they come around the home stretch, we were like, oh my God, Warholm was going to get beaten here, because Ry Benjamin, who was also running a world record time, if he'd run yesterday, it would have been a world record time. It looked like he was about to close the gap on him, and Warholm was like, not today, my friend, not today. He was right beside him. He was in the lane right beside him, and he managed to kick on and run an even more world record time. So he clocked 45.94 this morning. So that is the brand new record. His previous world record, which he set in Oslo at the start of July, was 46.70. So it was 46.70. It is now 45.94. I haven't gone through all the details to see by what magnitude. Like, when we've seen other records that have been broken by such a magnitude, especially when it is somebody breaking their own record. I'm trying to think when Usain Bolt broke his own world record in Berlin, was it by such a distance? And then he was also making the point on Twitter that time would have won all the Olympic gold medals up till 1960 on the 400 metre flat So if you put Carson Varahome back there, he could run over hurdles and he would still beat you if you were running on the flat, which is just absolutely incredible. And that Rye Benjamin performance in 46.17. So he'd gone, he had taken a huge degree off the previous world record as well. And then you had Brazil's Alessandro Santos in bronze, who was 46.72. So he came close to breaking the world record as well. And he only earned bronze. It was just crazy. It was like, and one of the things you start to think about when you're watching this, you start to put everything into an Irish context and you're like, is Thomas Berger in many ways one of the most unlucky Irish athletes we have? Because we were looking at him in Rio 2016 saying if he can peak again at the next Olympics, he might be in with a shout of a medal. But the problem for Tom Barr is that the 400 metre hurdles has become one of the most glamorous races in world athletics in the intervening 5 years. And he's, I guess, collateral damage in that. Again, he should be there. And I think he would have finished sixth or seventh with his time the previous day in today's final. So it just goes to show how classy he is as well. And I think that this is going to be something we'll get into as the morning develops. What are our expectations for Irish athletes? I think that the 400 metre hurdles probably puts into perspective just how competitive this game really is. With the exception of football, this is the most competitive sport you can possibly be in. And yes, we've had medal expectations when it comes to rowing and gymnastics and of course boxing. But medal expectations when it comes to athletics is on an entirely different level. And I think it puts into perspective things like Sonny O'Sullivan's silver medal. It puts into perspective Tom Barr's fourth place even 5 years ago as absolute all-time great Irish sporting moments.
Like, oh, without a question. And if we can have even one iota of the success in athletics as we've had in, for example, boxing and rowing, it would just be incredible. And look, Sonny O'Sullivan, as you said, it puts it into context now what she was achieving back then. But that race just, like, Carsten Warholm's from Norway. Norway is a population quite similar to Ireland. Can you imagine the euphoria and the hysteria over this guy over there? And the scary thing is as well, Owen, like, he's 25 years of age and there's only a 3-year turnaround until Paris. Like, this guy is going to be, he's going to be one of the poster boys for that Olympic Games, because that race yesterday, like, even heading to the last hurdle, I thought Rye Benjamin was going to do it. He was kind of lurking very, very dangerously on his shoulder. And just to see Warholm's reaction, like, ripping the vest, he just dug so deep to do it, because for a while in that last straight, it just looked like he wasn't going to do it. And when you look at, like you mentioned, Dos Santos's time in bronze, like, so close to that old world record, which just shows how scarily competitive this event is. Like, everyone in the stadium, it appeared, like, I know, of course, we didn't have a full stadium in Tokyo, but people were speechless, even when the camera panned around. Not only the athletes, the media, everyone else was just in shock. And to see a rivalry like that between Benjamin and Warholm, I just hope that continues over the next couple of years, because what an incredible race that was.
Yeah, and Warholm himself was one of the most astonished people in there. Like, I'd never seen the man smile in my entire life, but he did crack a smile when he was posing beside the new world record, the traditional photo when a world record is broken. So it really must have been special if even Carsten Varahome was smiling. But I mean, like, it seems that every second good young European athlete right now is European, whether it's Erling Haaland or Victor Hovland or Carsten Varahome. It's everybody new on the scene is basically Norwegian at this point. But
Scandinavians, yeah, they're killing it.
That is the big story from the athletics overnight. The big story, of course, is Kelly Harrington from an Irish perspective, and we are going to get into that in the performance rankings in just a moment. Let's tell you what's coming up on OTBAM this morning. So, the performance rankings, as I said, coming your way in 1 minute's time. We've got boxing with Rona Mullen at 8:10. He's going to break down Kelly Harrington's fight earlier on and her chances of upgrading her medal to at least a silver on Thursday morning. Cathal Dennehy will be with us to break down that incredible race at 8:25 and also talk about the Irish in action. It's been a morning of mixed success once again on the track. Anthony Moyles then will be chatting Gaelic football at 8:40, and then the Lions with Fiona Hayes coming your way at 9:10. Then plenty of OTB reaction to the weekend sport as well at 9:30. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. It is 7:40 on this Tuesday morning. It is time for the Gillette Performance Rankings.
You know, that wasn't an All-Ireland winning performance.
Probably should have won the game based on the second half performance.
Is it a step too far to say it was the performance so far of the World Cup? Maybe not.
OTBAM's Performance Rankings with Gillette.
I'm scratching my head. The performances were just lacked that intensity.
Every week on OTB AM, we give you the chance to win a Gillette starter pack here on our performance rankings. All you have to do is send us in your suggestions for the good, the bad and the grand. And we'll pick a winner before 9:30. So many contenders, Shane, this morning for all the different spots. Let's have a look at our sidebar to see who is in the red first off this morning. And I think we're going to start this morning with Leinster Football. You are putting the Leinster Football Championship into the red, despite the fact that the final was decided by single figures on Sunday, Shane. What's going on here?
It's a joke, Owen. It is a joke, the Leinster Senior Football Championship. Like, I went, as you said, to Croke Park on Saturday afternoon to watch the Ulster Football Final with hope in my heart that my own County Monaghan could win it. They didn't, but that's the beautiful thing about Ulster football is that you go to these games not knowing the outcome. Now, anyone who went to Croke Park the following day, 24 hours later on Sunday, knew the outcome of the game before they went. And it was just... You see, like Kildare fans, of course, they go to the game with that little sinew of hope. But reality is, this Dublin team are just far too dominant. Like, I had almost forgotten how many Leinsters in a row until I saw the push notifications coming in after the game on Sunday. 11 Leinster titles in a row is joke stuff. Like, this cannot be happening, Owen. And to see it, the only thing that's giving me a saving grace here is the fact that Meath are the minor Leinster champions and Offaly are the under 20 Leinster champions. So there is a little bit of hope left that maybe what's coming through the ranks and the underage teams coming through, Dublin don't have the dominance that they do at senior level. That is the only thing I'm clinging on to here. But
what about the margins of victory, Shane? Is that not another reason to give you hope? Like, are we not saying that Dublin maybe have closed the gap themselves and have come back to the pack a little bit more? Like, three games in a row in the Leinster Championship where they've won by only single digits. When was the last time that happened? Like, it sounds to me this morning that you're very much in the camp that Dublin have been playing it cool and have not been trying at all.
Like, of course they've been trying. It's Championship football, but at the same time, like, an 8-point win in a provincial final in any year is a big win. And it's just the manner of it as well, because Kildare get the goal and you're thinking, oh, we could make a game out of this here. And then the big players step up, Cormac Costlow, Brian Howard, all of these guys all of a sudden, Kieran Kilkenny, do what they usually do and they just nip it in the bud. They tip over scores at just the right time to kill any margin of hope. And that's the way Dublin games have gone. Like, we all kind of got a little bit excited after the Wexford game at the start of the year. And I think the Wexford players going to the first water break, led by a point or two maybe, and they got a standing ovation from the Wexford support. But that's just little tiny bits of hope that we cling on to. This Dublin team, as I said, the right moments in the game, they just kill it off. And if we're gonna try and hold on to things like single digit victories as beacons of hope for the Leinster Championship, then we're really in trouble, because an 8 or 9 point win is still an absolute trouncing in any other province. If Galway beat Mayo, or if Mayo beat Galway by a point, it's a trouncing. If Monaghan beat Tyrone, or Tyrone beat Monaghan by 8 or 9 points, it's a trouncing. And it should not be considered anything else for Dublin to beat Kildare or whoever it might be, or Meath or Wexford, by anything less than single digits. It's still a trouncing, Owen, and the Leinster Championship's in trouble.
But what would the 2017 Dublin team, for example, or the 2018 or 19 Dublin team have done in the last three games, do we think?
Like, yes, they probably would have won by a bigger margin. But you have to remember, Dublin have lost some big players. Stephen Cluxton's wasn't the man lifting the Leinster trophy for the first time in a long time for Dublin, and Johnny Cooper got the honours. But they are missing some players. It's a team in transition as well. There's no longer Jim Gavin at the helm. We have Desi Farrell in there now. It's going to take a little bit of time for Desi Farrell to stamp his authority in this Dublin team. But if they're winning Leinster titles by 8 points, I mean... He's not doing badly. And there were so many years where Dublin fans would have absolutely dreamed of Leinster titles as easily as they can win them now. But like, we'll talk to Anthony Miles a little bit later on. When he was starting off his Meath career, if you told him that there would be a point between 2011 and 2021 where Dublin would win 11 Leinster titles in a row, he'd have laughed at you. Not a chance. Not a hope.
I wouldn't like to hear your appraisal of the Munster Championship, because am I right? It was 8-6-8 were the three winning margins, which is an accumulation of 22 points, and Kerry won the Munster final by 22 points. So are we, like, is Leinster football even the worst football championship?
Yes, it is the worst football championship. Like, Munster, yeah, of course, this year the Munster Championship was just dominated by an excellent Kerry team, but it's year after year after year in Leinster. Like last year, at least we had the surprise of Cork beating Kerry and then Tip beating Cork, and there was a little element of hope that there could be surprise results. Any team heading into the Ulster Championship this year, I could have made a case for. Like, I could have even made a case for Antrim as a surprise. Like, Division 4 promoted to Division 3, Enda McGinley doing good things with them. Armagh Monaghan was a toss-up. Tyrone Donegal was a toss-up. You had Derry doing serious things as well and could have beaten Donegal. All of the games were just up in the air. And then you have, even at underage level, Downs under 20s coming through with power. Derry at underage level are really strong. Cavan traditionally are as well. Like, the only provinces keeping my interest alive at provincial stage in the football is Connacht and Ulster. And even in Connacht, you've only really got three teams that can probably win it in Roscommon, Mayo and Galway. But no, the Leinster Championship, I don't know what the solution is. Maybe Anthony Moyles might have the answers for us a little bit later. But like, I still enjoy the provincial championships, probably because of Ulster keeping the interest there for me as a proud Monaghan man. But no, the Leinster Championship is just a joke. But look, that the hope, as I said, Meath winning the minor and Offaly winning the under-20s, at least that gives us something to clutch onto.
I don't know. I think there are green shoots of hope. I think the provincial system is beyond saving at this point. And I do agree with you that it's probably going to be changed at the end of this year anyway. But I just think that if you wanted to pick one year to watch Leinster football out of the last 10 years, this is probably the most compelling. I know it doesn't say much at all for the state of the Leinster Championship when you can say that, but it's been better than anything I can remember over the last 5 or 6 years, because Dublin have just been off it a little bit. And yes, I accept that there is a massive Dublin kick coming at some point, and some team are going to fall victim to that in very, very brutal fashion. It could be Mayo, it could be Tyrone or Kerry. Who knows when it's going to happen, and it probably will happen. But the alternative view to that is that the previous iterations of Dublin, the peak Jim Gavin Dublin team, would never have allowed these games to be a little bit questionable early in the second half. And that's what all those games have been. I know the reality is that nobody had any questions over the result, because this is Dublin and those teams are Wexford, Meath and Kildare, and we know their form. But if you're an alien coming to watch those games, those three games, they're up for decision early in the second half. None of Dublin's Leinster games over the last 5 or 6 years were up for decision early in the second half. They were all dead, absolutely gone early in the first half. So something has changed, and I don't know, can any intercounty team actually wake up one day and say, listen, we are going to change something, and the change we are going to make is being less dominant. I just don't see how that benefits anybody whatsoever. And yes, I accept, again, just to reiterate, that Dublin will kick on at some point, but I'm very much in the camp at the moment that something is just not 100% right. Like, Dean Rock isn't deliberately getting the ball on the right flank and ballooning the ball straight up into the air. Like, there are certain moments where, like, that's going over to black spot in previous years. Conor Callaghan isn't deliberately operating on the fringes of the team. Like, something is not right. The things that they're doing, they are not doing deliberately. And I don't think the whole third gear element, which, let's face it, they're in, is all down to Dublin creating some sort of master plan. I think that there are enough red flags that would ensure that these last two games for them in this year's championship will at least lead to two real tests. And I think Mayo will give them a real test in the All-Ireland semi-final. What I would say then, to almost counteract that point, is look at the sort of the reasonable things that are going to happen over the next little while, and the kind of John Small coming back into the team and being ahead of schedule with his return to fitness is a massive fill-up for Dublin. Owen Merchant, the exact same thing. It's not just because of what they offer in the backs, but it will allow the likes of Brian Howard and James McCarthy to play further forward. Maybe Brian Howard joins Brian Fenton in midfield and James McCarthy resumes at centre back. That for me just transforms how Dublin look, and all of a sudden that starting 15 looks the best starting 15 in Ireland. But you have to say, Shane, that when you go through that bench, it is definitely not as strong as it was in previous years. And there is a strong case to be made that Kerry actually have a better 26 than Dublin do at this point.
Oh, you've said it, Owen. You've said it. As a Kerry man, you finally said it. I mean, this is the thing. And you said it yourself there. Dublin are in third gear. Like, no other county. Like, Tyrone couldn't have won the Ulster Championship in third gear. Mayo couldn't have won the Connacht Championship probably in third gear. Like, the fact that they can win a province in, as you said, third gear is the problem here. And look, GAA fans, it's the hope that kills you. And Mayo fans are probably the fans that have had most hope dashed over the last number of years. And let's be real, they are going into this semi-final against the Dubs with as much hope as you could possibly expect to have against Dublin, because, as you said, they certainly have shown flaws. And I'm not saying Dublin are the be-all and end-all this year, because they're certainly not. And as you said, look, Jim Gavin, 2017, 2016 kind of teams were probably better than this current Dub setup in terms of the strength and depth. But no, the Mayo fans' hope will be at an all-time high for an All-Ireland semi-final against Dublin, and I cannot wait for that game.
It is going to be the mother of all battles for tickets for that game. Let's not forget that it was quite a battle to get a ticket for a full 82,000 stadium in 2019 when they last played in an All-Ireland semi-final. So what is it? Is it 30,000? Is it for the semi-final? That is just going to be one hell of a battle for tickets for that one. Next up in the red is Harry Kane, Shane. Why have you put Harry Kane in the red?
Well, Owen, we saw that the headlines, and the headlines are in the newspapers this morning as well, across the weekend as well. Harry Kane missing pre-season training for Tottenham yesterday. Tottenham understood to be, quote, disappointed, Owen. Kane telling Spurs in May, of course, he wanted to leave this summer. Manchester City making that £100 million bid for him in June. Now, Kane was due to return to Hotspur Way yesterday, as I said, following the short holiday. He's had a bit of time off since the Euros ended. And when there's speculation around your future and you don't turn up to pre-season training on the first day.
Oh, we have lost Shane. Are we going to get Shane back? Is he going to magically reappear? Yeah, he's frozen. The Wi-Fi in Monaghan lets us down once again here on OTBAM. It is 7:51 on this Monday morning. I'm going to take you around some of the back pages this morning. Loads of things going on. It's hard to kind of nail down what is the lead this morning. The main photo on the back of the Irish Independent is Sean Emanuel of Meath celebrating their victory over Dublin in their minor football championship final in the Leinster final in minors. The main story though, Kane faces fine for no-show, and this is what Shane has been talking about. He has been he's taken drastic action in his attempt to force through a move to Manchester City by refusing to report to training at the start of pre-season with Tottenham, and he is now risking a heavy fine. How heavy a fine for a player that earns €234,000 a week? That will actually make a difference, I'm not so sure. But he feels he's got a gentleman's agreement with Daniel Levy. He acted like a gentleman last summer, he feels, in terms of actually staying there. Whereas now, the gloves are off and it's got personal at this point. Harry Kane wants to leave Tottenham by any means necessary, Shane.
Like, the Kane stuff is ridiculous. Like, I think there was a quote from Rio Ferdinand on Twitter that summed it up quite nicely, Owen. Let Paul Pogba not turn up for Man United training and see how the English media and fans go mad. Helicopters and police forces will be out searching his location immediately. That sums it up. Like, Harry Kane gets off scot-free from the English press, Owen. He's the darling of the English media. Like, it's ridiculous. It's a joke, again. Like, It's as big a joke as the Leinster Senior Football Championship. The treatment Harry Kane gets. He's the pet. He's the pet in the corner of the teacher's classroom who's a bold boy, but he gets away with it. Like, it's just, this is a farce. You have to show up for pre-season training. Like, regardless of gentlemen's agreements, like you mentioned with Daniel Levy, you signed a 6-year contract. So, you know, and what is it? 3 years left on it. Like, don't force your way out of a club like this. This is a club that, clearly, he wants out of because he wants to win trophies. And I understand that. I understand why he would want to sign for Manchester City or Chelsea or Manchester United or Real Madrid. But do it in the proper way and don't let down the fans like this, because it's ridiculous.
Well, what does he have to gain by doing this, Shane? It is always my question when somebody doesn't show up for a pre-season training, because so many players, like before the transfer window moved its deadline to before the season, so many players would like play a couple of games for their club at the start of the season and then move to a rival club after playing a couple of games. Like, that's just the reality of football. I mean, you show up, you do your job, and you sign for somebody else, and that's fine. Like, they play Manchester City on the opening day of the season. I don't think anybody would bat an eyelid in the old days if he lined out against Manchester City on the opening day of the season and then joined that club a couple of days later. We get it. That's how it works. You can show up to training and still force your way out of the club. I mean, you can still be a pro and also be aggressive off the field trying to get your move. Is it just kind of like, I don't want to break up with somebody break up with somebody in person. I want to do it via text. Is that the sort of way he's trying to get out of things here? Is it just awkwardness? He doesn't want to meet Nuno. He doesn't want to meet his teammates because he wants to hide his face from them because he knows he's a little bit too good for them. Is that what he's trying to do here?
It's cowardice. Show up for training. Show your face. Okay, you might want to force your way out of the club, but do it in a respectful manner, Harry. Come on. I mean, I understand that Daniel Levy could be a tough man to deal with. And like we saw in the Spurs, but like Behind Closed Doors documentary, like even his discussions with Christian Eriksen in that show, like, you can see that he takes a firm stand, Daniel Levy, and sometimes players have to force their way out of the club. I get that. Like, if you're contracted, you want to force your way out. Not showing up for training and being in, well, what appears to be breach of contract is not the way to go about it. And it's certainly not the way to do it, you know, for the fans. I think yesterday was only supposed to be like a quick COVID test and a quick catch up ahead of the season. There was no real training as such, but you still show up. And there's no doubt Harry knew to show up. He's in WhatsApp groups and whatever else with the rest of the team. He sees when he needs to show up. And he just didn't. So it'll be interesting to see. This week's going to tell all, I think.
And is there not a case to be made here as well that he's still at the mercy of Daniel Levy? Yes, there may have been a gentleman's agreement, but for him to move, Daniel Levy is going to have to give the green light for a certain bid to come in from Manchester City. If Daniel Levy is the vindictive type, and I'm not sure if he is or not, but if he's the vindictive type, is he not thinking to himself, screw you, Man City, I'm not accepting anything under a certain amount, and that amount has gone up and up and up because the player's not showing up for training? He can lock him in if he really wants to. Like, I'm not sure. I just don't understand the tactics sometimes to not showing up for training. I'm just not sure how that forces through a move. I think you show up for training, you stay classy right till the end, and then surely Daniel Levy gets guilted into being like, all right, away you go, Harry. You've done your bit here. We accept that. So I'm not sure. Like, the other thing that kind of came to mind as well is, would Tottenham be in a better position now if Jose was still manager? Like, I'm not saying he'd be able to persuade Harry Kane, but I'm pretty sure Nuno has no chance of persuading Harry Kane. Like, I know we saw a glimpse into their relationship in the Amazon documentary, but Jose's whole thing was, I'm going to make you explode. Like, Jose may not be the best manager in the world anymore. He's far from it, and he probably deserved to probably lose his job at Tottenham Hotspur given the squad they had. But at the same time, is he good enough to stroke the ego of Harry Kane enough where he might have considered staying on, or at least maybe showing up for training?
Yeah, you need a big name manager there in order for him to stay at Tottenham. Nuno Espirito Santo is a fantastic football manager, but the fact is, he's not the big name draw that maybe might have whispered in the ear of Harry Kane and persuaded him to stay. And then you've Daniel Levy building his foot soldiers around him, making his position at the club even stronger. Like, he hired Fabio Paratici, the former Juventus football officer, to this managing director of football role. And he's just building people around him that makes his position at Spurs even stronger. And look, he spoke a couple of months ago, back in June, about his empathising with Kane's position on wanting silverware. But he hinted back then that a deal to sell Harry Kane could be quite difficult to do. Harry Kane, listening to that back in June and looking back at the headlines, is thinking to himself, this guy's not going to let me away easily here. I'm going to have to do something to garner headlines and to make life impossibly difficult for Daniel Levy. And look, not showing up for training is one way to go about that.
How's this going to play out, do you think?
Kane's going. There's no doubt about it. If a footballer wants to leave, yeah, okay, someone's going to have to show up with the money. It's 120 million, I think they want. Like, he's worth that. He's worth 120 million pounds in today's market. Jack Grealish, we saw the figures being bandied around for him. So the fact of the matter is, Manchester City have the money. Pep Guardiola will ultimately pay it, and he will move probably to Manchester City, and it's going to happen. So whether Daniel Levy wants to put his foot down for the next week, 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, he can do that, but he's only postponing the inevitable, I think.
So the Leinster Football Championship and Harry Kane are in the bad this week in our Gillette Performance Rankings. In amber, we are going with Sebastian Vettel, Shane. I'm not going to lie, I saw none of this at the weekend. It's been Olympics and GAA and Lions Central for me. So explain to me and everybody else who missed this over the course of the weekend, what happened?
There's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot happening in the Formula One at the moment. And like, I'm absolutely cannot wait for the coming weeks in Formula One, because we've got a 3 week break now. But then it's the Belgian Grand Prix in Spa, which I will be attending, my first time leaving the country since COVID all kicked off. So myself and a few mates are heading over to experience a Grand Prix in person, which I just cannot wait for. But yeah, Sebastian Vettel had a mixed weekend, it would have to be said, why he's in amber here this morning. Like, there was an incident. So essentially, Vettel finishes second. Esteban Ocon, surprise winner of this race. Sebastian Vettel comes in second and Lewis Hamilton in third. But the way in which it happened saw Sebastian Vettel pulled of that second position. So essentially in this Hungarian Grand Prix, his car was thrown out of the results late on Sunday night, Vettel, after the FIA's technical delegate was unable to take a sufficient fuel sample after the race. So you have to essentially have 1 litre of fuel taken out of your car essentially a sample pumped out of the car after each race as a, it's just a formality really. They just test a few and make sure there's nothing, no Monaghan green diesel or dodgy diesel in
no,
it.
No EPO
example.
In the diesel.
No EPO essentially, yeah, no performance enhancing diesel. Mm. And what happened was only 0.3 litres could be taken out of Vettel's car and not the mandated 1 litre. So Aston Martin, which is Vettel's team, have lodged their intent to appeal this decision. They had until Thursday to do it. They believe there should have been still 1.44 litres of fuel in the car. Now, that's a very specific number, Owen. They knew in their heads how much fuel they thought was left in that car. 1.44 litres, they said. They said it should have been no problem to take 1 litre out, but only 0.3 litres could be taken out. So the publication of the result then on Sunday, initially it caused a bit of confusion because Vettel was still being shown in second place in the classification. There was a note attached saying the result was provisional, subject to the outcome of Aston Martin's appeal. But then a corrected version came out of the results yesterday and Vettel was duly listed as DSQ, disqualified. So that moves Hamilton up to second, Ferrari's Carlos Sainz up to the podium into third. And this is all, of course, pending this appeal and not being successful. So every driver behind moved up a place. They took Max Verstappen up to ninth from 10th as well, so increased an increased a point for him. So just a disappointing one for Sebastian Vettel. He had also made headlines before the race as well, Owen. So he wore a T-shirt, same love, rainbow T-shirt in support of the LGBTQ plus community before the race. So, of course, we all know the political situation in Hungary and the thoughts on gay marriage over there. And Sebastian Vettel wanted to make this stand. He wore this same love, rainbow T-shirt during the Hungarian national anthem. And that is the crucial part here, because under FIA rules, drivers are permitted to carry a message that conveys the sport's We Race As One initiative during the pre-race ceremony. But that clothing must be removed for the national anthem. Now, Vettel was called to the stewards. He wore his T-shirt for the duration of the Hungarian national anthem, explained to them he forgot to remove the T-shirt because of the rain. So it started to rain and he says he forgot to remove his T-shirt. Now, other drivers also did not take theirs off either. Valtteri Bottas, Carlos Sainz, Lance Stroll, all doing the same. And as a result of leaving the T-shirt on, Sebastian Vettel has been reprimanded by the FIA. And then Lewis Hamilton, who of course has done a lot for equality and for rights and for standing up for initiatives and issues he believes in, tweeted or put up on Instagram, super proud of this guy. There is no rule that says what colour shirt you can wear, and supporting the LGBTQ plus community is not reprimandable. This is BS. Well done, Seb. I'll join you next time with the same shirt. And he updated the post to say, love to see this. Love always wins. So Sebastian Vettel doing good things and standing up to the Hungarian madness. But yeah, on the track, having a bit of an off day, unfortunately for him, having his second place taken off him.
Right, so that's Sebastian Vettel. Mixed fortunes for him over the course of the last little while then, so he's in amber. We move on to green then in this morning's performance rankings. Let's quickly touch on hurling here, Shane. I think we all, well, maybe just me, we gave hurling a pretty bad rap during the National League, and I think we have to apologise to the hurling community this morning for such a bad rap, complaining about scores being landed from distance. I mean, this was just a first world problem, a first world hurling problem, because what we're seeing at the moment is, I don't know, the riches at the very top tier just allow us to witness some extraordinary clashes. This weekend's semi-finals are teed up beautifully. I always say that the modern hurling semi-final weekend, when both games have been on the same weekend, is probably the best weekend in Irish sport. They're probably both going to be absolute crackers. Obviously, Dublin Cork maybe didn't have the exact level of tension that Waterford Tipperary had, but it didn't really matter because Waterford Tipperary was possibly the game of the year. But it's got to beat off some pretty strong contest to be the game of the year at this point. You just kind of go into all these games not really knowing the outcome. Now, I know Limerick may skew that a little bit, but when it comes to these teams, anybody in the top eight who are playing each other, with the exception of Limerick, you really kind of don't know how things are going to go in those games. And what has been served up, despite the fact that it is a condensed championship, is just another cracker of a hurling summer, despite the fact that we were all giving out about hurling at the start of the year.
Well, this is the thing. You said it yourself, like, not knowing the outcome. That's why the Leinster Football Championship is in the red. And that's why hurling is in the green, because you do not know the outcome heading into these matches. And I was sitting in the pub in Dublin ahead of the Monaghan Tyrone match on Saturday, watching this Waterford Tip game. And there was a fella from Tip beside me and his young son from Waterford in the Waterford jersey. And they were just pacing back and forth, couldn't watch this is the beauty of it. And the emotion from them at full time was just beautiful to see. Like, what a match. And of that 428, like 428, by the way, is just an outrageous scoreline, even in hurling. But 325 from play, and 13 different scorers for Waterford. Like, what a game of hurling. And really, really good advertisement for the game. And we seem to say that a lot about hurling because we get a lot of cracking matches. But the fact that even at halftime, it was only, I think, a point in it in Waterford's favour. And even though Waterford were quite noticeably the better team and certainly started off the better. But just really, really exciting. And the thing for Waterford as well, 4 weeks in a row, they're going to have to be playing at that intensity. Mm. Like, that's the difficult thing for them heading into this weekend. Like, the manager speaking afterwards about the boys being well conditioned, saying it's about recovery and sleep and that sort of thing this week. And look, they have the nutritionists and they have the sports psychologists and everyone to kind of prime them for it. But going out in Croke Park in an All Ireland semi final after the few weeks in advance of that they've had, I mean, and the breathless tempo that they play with as well, Owen, especially in that game at the weekend, that's not easy.
Yeah.
So heading into this game, difficult one for them, but. Yeah, a huge, huge match ahead.
And the way Limerick kicked on in the second half against Tip would suggest to me that we're going to get this incredible opening half where Waterford may go hammer and tongs and might actually look like they're going to do something special, and then Limerick possibly pull away in the second half. Like, it's going to be really interesting. I think, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm the only person who's thinking this, but I kind of want to see Limerick win and I want to see Kilkenny win, and I want to see that as the All-Ireland final. I want a rematch for the 2019 All-Ireland semi-final, the only time when Limerick have really looked mortal over the course of a full 70-80 minutes. So that is the final I want to see, and I hope we get it. Just to mention then, our final person in the green who we're going to get into properly now over the next 15 or 20 minutes, it is, of course, Kelly Harrington. She is officially an Olympic medalist. She was delighted this morning, but there is a reservation there as well, because she knows that she is good enough to go another two steps. She knows she's good enough to win gold. She knows she's definitely good enough to get at least silver over the next little while. She won earlier on against Khalif, her opponent, who didn't really cause her too many troubles with the exception of her biology, really, that she was taller, she had a longer reach, and she tried to keep Harrington at her distance, and when Harrington did manage to get inside that reach, she was devastating. And Khalif was awkward. Kelly Harrington in her post-fight interview was imitating the sounds that Khalif was making as she was approaching her, which sounded like it was a pretty stressful thing to be looking at. She cited the Lion King twice, she said Hakuna Matata a number of times. That is her philosophy. Some people watch motivational videos to get themselves up for the Olympic Games. Kelly Harrington watches the Lion King, and it is serving her in really good stead. Again, like most of these Irish fighters, she credits her coaches for doing a really good job, and I think Czar has pretty much nailed the tactics on quite a few occasions this time, and it's been no different for Kelly Harrington. It was obviously a disappointing Sunday when it came to the boxers waking up to the news that Aidan Walsh was not going to be fighting, and Kurt Walker going out in dramatic enough fashion as well. But Kelly Harrington has got the good times going again. There is one last good news story, hopefully, for Ireland in this Olympic Games, and Kelly Harrington might well be it. So Thursday morning against Sison D of Thailand is going to be something that I'm sure everybody will be getting up to watch, because I think it's at like 6 o'clock in the morning. So it's worked out brilliantly for Ireland that it's on that late. But Kelly Harrington is where we finish. We are going to get Ronan Mullins' take on that in just a moment. But that is this week's Gillette Performance Rankings.
OTBAM's Performance Rankings with Gillette.
It is 8 minutes past eight on this Tuesday morning, and we've got a packed show still to come on OTBAM. We're going to be talking Gaelic football with Anthony Moyles. There is the Lions with Fiona Hayes after 9 o'clock. We're back after these, talking boxing with Ronan.
OTBAM.
It is 10 minutes past eight. You're very welcome back. So, Ronan Mullen, good morning to you.
Hakuna Matata, Owen. How are things?
Hakuna Matata, indeed. Kelly Harrington, Olympic medalist.
Yeah, she was brilliant, wasn't she? And like, you can't always translate it to what happens in the fight, but she just exuded such a sense of belonging in a ring walk. It was like Manny Pacquiao-esque in his heyday, where you just so serene and you knew she was clued into the task at hand. And I think, as you touched on a couple of minutes ago, it was never really in doubt. Khalif didn't overly trouble her on the scorecards, and she was pretty much in control for the full 9 minutes. And sort of an incremental rise in difficulty throughout this tournament. She didn't have many issues in her last fight either. This one was slightly trickier, just given the dimensions that were put in front of her. But as we said last week, it doesn't matter what you present to Kelly Harrington, she can adapt. She's so malleable, style-wise and temperament-wise, and you know, breeze to a bronze medal, really, in relative terms, and just a brilliant performance and a good fill-up for Team Ireland, boxing-wise and in the broader scheme of things, because it was a difficult weekend.
Yeah, it certainly was. Sunday, not so super Sunday, to say the very least, and it was just heartbreak left, right and centre. It wasn't even like complete car crash stuff. It was just narrow margins of defeat. And I'm sure, Ronan, there is such a close relationship between Kurt Walker and Aidan Walsh and Kelly Harrington that it is really a team mood, and a team mood that has been shifted this morning.
Yeah, for sure. And I think Kelly, after her first fight, cited Brendan Irvine, obviously the dual Olympian in the team and captain of the boxing team. And he obviously went out in the early throes of this tournament, but she spoke to how important he's been. And we had Emmett Brennan on the other day, and he's obviously central to the morale of the camp as well. So yeah, as you said, a very tight-knit group. And the Team Ireland vibe, I just have been so blown away by how impressive they've all been in their media dealings as well. And even Rory McIlroy, who, you know, we don't have to retread his commitment to the Team Ireland cause, Owen, but like even him, you could see him beaming as just being a part of the collective. They seem to have real camaraderie in the broader 100 plus athletes, and in the little microcosm of this boxing team. Thankfully, we've got the good ship Irish boxing back on track here, and two medals is nothing to be sniffed at. I think we can be very happy with that.
Absolutely. So just to get back to this morning's fight then, so you've obviously spoken there about the way Kelly Harrington's managed to figure out a lot of these bouts. Do you think that they've set out almost a bracket for themselves before the games, where she kind of knows the fighters she's expected to fight and she works on game plans for all of them? Or is it actually kind of down to her herself to figure it out in fight, because there just isn't enough time to go through all the possible permutations of opponents?
Yeah, with Rebecca Nicolai in the last round, Team Ireland would have had a good bit of tape on her. They would have come up against her in past competition, and like it was a nice draw for Kelly to get things started as far as Olympic debuts go. Some of her counterparts in the team didn't have it so lucky, but she was quite happy with that initial draw. This was a trickier one on paper. You know, Khalif brought a different set of skills to the table, really. And while it's good preparation in the sense that she's had to adapt to two different styles so far, like it's going to be a huge fall forward in quality in her next fight, as compared to Cesson D, who had a real tough fight today against Caroline Dubois and has had her acid test going into the semi-final. Kelly, if you had to nitpick, could say she's going in slightly cold in terms of the level of competition she's fought so far, not to diminish them, but if you compare Caroline Dubois to what Kelly's faced so far, there's probably no competition. So I'd still back her. She's got form against Cesson D going into the semi-final, beat her in the World Championships of 2018. It's a great styles matchup. Two very accomplished boxers who've both boxed at higher weights and come down to really flourish in the lightweight division. So it's an excellent fight. You know, obviously at the business end of the Olympics, a lot of the semi-finals and finals are going to be elite tier, but there's nothing between them really, and it's a very enthralling fight in prospect, I would say.
Ronan, am I reading too much into it to suggest, you know, with the draw being made and Aidan Walsh getting that look of the draw and the bye from through the first round, we know Kelly Harrington got the bye as well based on her seeding, and Michaela Walsh, unfortunately, she couldn't medal, but got the bye as well. Like, having that one less fight, is that a huge advantage? Is it? Am I reading too much into it to say that our two medalists had the one less fight and the less battering of their bodies, I guess?
No, it's an interesting point, and obviously you're correct in citing that Aidan Walsh was quote-unquote lucky to get his bye in, that it was just a lottery bye, whereas Kelly, based off seeding, and you know, it's just a numbers game with that, and like it has played to her advantage in one sense, but also she was the last member of the Irish boxing team to step into the ring, and as we all know, Kelly Harrington, you know, she was getting itchy hands, I'm sure. She was dying to get in there and blow off the cobwebs last Friday, so it looks like she's built nice momentum in these two fights already and really hit the ground running on Friday and improved, I would say, an even better performance this time around. We'll need a super quality performance on Thursday to get the silver medal, gold medal contention, but I think that goes without saying. The best thing you can say about her is, and you kind of phrased it in the intro there, Owen, that she's taken it all in her stride. She's, while somewhat emotional to have secured Olympic medalist status, she knows this isn't the end of her journey. She came here with higher hopes, and it's somewhat similar to O'Donovan and McCarthy in the rowing, whereas that seemed more like a foregone conclusion. I don't want to draw a direct parallel, whereas they were the clear favourites. Kelly's got some seriously choppy waters to navigate, especially on the other side of the draw where Mira Pakkinen is over there, and the Brazilian current world medalist, who's probably a gold medal favourite if you're looking at the bookmakers. So I think it's not a foregone conclusion by any means, but Kelly Harrington knows she's got a gold medal talent and she'll want to deliver on that.
Like, it's her attitude, like, as well, Ronan. Like, you mentioned, like, even the Lion King quotes, like, the walkout, the confidence. Like, and one of the quotes from her after the fight last night, she says, "Sometimes I think I'm lucky. You can't be that lucky, though, to be winning all these things and then end up here and have a bronze medal in the Olympic Games." Like, she's right. She has earned this. And, like, have you seen Sisondi being a matchup from a repeat of the 2018 fight makes it all the more interesting? Like, is Kelly Harrington a better fighter than she was even in 2018?
Yeah, they've both got really interesting trajectories, but obviously from our own perspective, Kelly Harrington coming off the back of profound success from Katie Taylor in the exact same division, like, the parallels are clear to be seen. And she obviously had to bide her time. 31 is prime age for boxer, so it's not as if she's coming late to the party or anything like that, but this is very much her time. And, you know, while the Paris Games is only 3 years away, this is kind of her moment. If she's going to become an Olympic champion, you'd think it would be this one. And Sisondi, similar age profile and similar journey in that she did come down to 60 kgs for the Olympic chance and, like, showed her credentials in that World Championships in 2018, where got a big upset win in the semi-final. The final itself, I watched a bit of it back this morning while I was double screening with Timmy McCarthy, Team USA in the background. But, you know, it's an interesting one for Kelly to navigate. You know, Sisondi is a southpaw. You saw Kelly today switching between southpaw and orthodox. I don't think we can underestimate the difficulty of how brilliantly she does that. Like, that's basically like playing golf with both hands, or playing snooker with both hands, Shane, if you want to put it like that. But she was in that final a couple of years ago. Sisondi is slightly smaller. You see Kelly today, the way she changes levels against the taller opponents, she'll be doing that conversely this time, where she'll be kind of coming down in levels to meet Sisondi and try and outbox her that way. That's how that first fight panned out. Obviously, 3 years ago, things have changed ever so slightly. But if anything, I would say Kelly Harrington's got better. She's overcome injuries in 2019. 2020 was a write-off on the sports terms for everybody, obviously, but I would say she's in a better position now than she would have been 12 months ago. And for that, I think we should be grateful too.
What sort of difficulties? I mean, like, it's pretty obvious the difficulty that being a switcher provides to your opponent, but is it something that any of her possible opponents, any of the other fighters left in this, have in their locker as well?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult one. Like, Sisondi is a little bit more, I would say, orthodox. It's obviously a contradiction in terms, but she's more straightforward in her boxing style, but will pose problems in that regard. Whereas she, as a southpaw, is used to coming up against orthodox fighters. She's not used to coming up against switch hitters like Kelly Harrington. And the way she does it, sometimes some fighters do it for the sake of doing it almost, whereas it is very fluid for Kelly. It's almost second nature, where she'll be in a clinch or in an exchange on the inside, and as she steps back out, she'll just be in the other stance. And she's forever changing the picture in front of her opponent. And you can almost see it sometimes against lesser opponents, where you can visualize them processing the picture that's in front of them. And as they're doing that, Kelly will score with a combination and move away. And within that, that's how the rounds start to creep away from her. So she's, like, let's not beat around the bush. Like, this is an elite, world-class athlete we have on our hands here, and they don't come around all that often on the world stage for Ireland, so we should enjoy her. This is a bronze medal, as we should, like, if we go back to the start of the conversation, not to be sniffed at. A brilliant achievement, 18 boxing medals for Ireland all time, but we have very few gold medal chances, and this is very much a gold medal chance. And I think we would be disappointed if Kelly doesn't at least give a really good account of herself in this semi-final and give herself a shot of being an Olympic champion.
Is there any concern, Ronan, about the slight damage she takes when she lands herself, or is that just the nature of the beast, the quality of the opposition and the way her aggression, like, I mean, when she tries to get in, she's landing multiple punches, she's not just getting a jab and leaving. So is that just the nature of the beast that you take one or two if you're going to try and land multiple hits?
Yeah, like, I do think the final or the semi-final on Thursday will be more of a technical matchup. So it probably, like, she will have to take some to give some. You can't swim without getting wet, to use all these boxing cliches, but she... She's excellent on the inside. She's excellent middle distance. She could box at long range, but like today, it just necessitated getting in there and sort of getting past the jab of Khalif. So, you know, it's a difficult one to navigate, but she did it adeptly. I thought she was quite sparing in the shots that she took, and most of the shots she did take were cuffing, sort of clubbing shots from Khalif, not as polished as what Kelly was doing. That probably won't be the case on Thursday, in the sense that Sisand will be picking very polished shots, and I think it will be more of a high level chess match. But I think it's one very much to look forward to. It's kind of the peak of the powers of Olympic boxing.
And did you expect Caroline Dubois to win this morning?
It was an interesting fight. I don't know if you saw it, Owen, but yeah, like RTE haven't been able to show many of the international fights outside of the Irish ones, unfortunately. But it was weird, like, because Dubois, the age profile, as we spoke about, she's obviously one of the younger people in these Olympic Games. It's probably come slightly early for her. But I thought she boxed pretty well in the first round and fended herself down 3-2. And like we learned ourselves from some of the quirky judging decisions from the weekend. But just her dealings with her corner in between that first round and second round, she seemed to unravel slightly as she came out for that second round. It's as if she thought the game plan wasn't working. And to my eye, it was working. She probably nicked that first round. But second round, Sisand Don came into it, sort of imprinted her expertise and her experience on her more juvenile opponent. And from that point, Dubois just couldn't get back into the fight. I think if they fought several times, if they fought 100 times, it would probably be pretty even. But like Caroline Dubois will be back. She will be a force in Paris if she's not snapped up by the pro game, because like, you'd see her style is very much suited in that regard. But I think Kelly won't be too perturbed with either opponent. I think she said the same in her interview, where she's beaten Sisand Don, she's beaten Dubois in recent months. So I think she'd be happy enough with whoever's on the table at this stage.
Ronan, you mentioned the decision to turn pro there, and like it just got me thinking about quotes from Jason Quigley on Off the Ball in the last number of days, and he was talking about that decision for him and how difficult it was to go from the amateur game into the professional ranks. Like, for a lot of Irish Olympic boxers now, that decision and that choice is going to have to come very shortly. Like, what considerations did dictate that choice? Is it usually things like age? Is it how a boxer, you know, what they achieve at the Olympic Games, whether they pick up the medal that they hope to get or get as far as they want to get? Or like, what dictates the decision-making process behind, you know, deciding eventually to go pro?
Yeah, I think obviously Olympic honours or international honours, that's the thrust of sort of your appeal. And Michael Conlon turned pro off the back of a somewhat ignominious spell in Rio, obviously, but he had that world gold to fall back on, decorated medalist. So he had a good, when he went with top rank, that was obviously his selling point. But like it kind of depends on each case. I think Kelly Harrington was speaking to your cell phone a couple of months ago and said she's not going to turn pro for buttons. But if she comes away with Olympic gold here, obviously there will be people knocking on her door for that. The Katie Taylor is probably, like, obviously could be a natural fight given the weight class, but it's probably a little bit pie in the sky at the moment. But that's the kind of sort of allure that if she was so inclined, she could turn over for a fight like that. But Kurt Walker's probably an interesting case study, where he's 26 now, 29 for Paris 2024. So he could easily hang around and would be a huge medal prospect, as was evidenced by his brilliant displays at this Olympics. But I think he, given his fighting style and the entertainment he brings, could be one that could be courted. But it does depend on each individual case, where the likes of Brendan Irvine, Emmett Brennan could also, their styles might lend themselves to the pros. The likes of Michaela Walsh, for example, very much like was really a medal contender at these games if things had gone our way, but will very much be in the mix alongside Aidan for Paris 2024. So that'd be my sort of reading on the seven at the moment. I think Aidan and Michaela will certainly stay amateur, and I think Kurt Walker might be the one who might be coaxed over to the pros.
Just on Kurt Walker, like, under no illusions that it was a certain Billy Walsh that drafted him into that Irish high performance unit in 2012. And like, to watch that fight at the weekend, losing to Duke Reagan, and a bittersweet moment, I guess, for Billy Walsh in training a guy to beat Kurt Walker at the Olympic Games and dash his medal hopes. But when you're watching that fight at the weekend, like, does that only kind of serve to highlight what we're missing in not having Billy Walsh involved in Irish boxing?
geez, it was heart-wrenching looking at the clip that was doing the rounds yesterday of Billy Walsh. Quite emotional, I think, having to... It's such a difficult... Imagine putting yourself in that situation where, as you said, Shane, picked him up in around 2012 time with the express intention, literally, of these Olympic Games, because obviously Michael Conlon and Paddy Barnes and such like were still around in 2016, so Kurt Walker would have been pegged for Tokyo, and the fact that it got to this stage and he, like Billy Walsh, was the one who sort of pulled the rug from under him, it's quite sad when you think about it. But no, to the wider point, I know that the Billy Walsh loss, it's crazy, really. Like, we're not in a position, as strong as Irish boxing is and the depth of talent we have in coaching terms and fighting terms, we're in no position to be letting international class of coach go like that. And Billy Walsh, it speaks to his reputation and renown around the world that he was out the Irish door a couple of minutes and Team USA, a behemoth of world sports, snapped him up and he is leading the charge. They were in the doldrums somewhat and now making a bit of a charge back on the Olympic, in the Olympic fray. So I'm delighted for Billy Walsh. Obviously gutted that how the fight the other night played out. Kurt Walker had such a brilliant duo of fights early in this and it was on the cusp of a medal and just got dealt a difficult fight. For me, I thought he won the fight. I thought he lost the first round conclusively and that's what ultimately did him in. I thought he won the second round and the third round. The vagaries of the scoring system are what they are. Like, I'm not going to be overly complaining about it because there is no perfect system in amateur boxing scoring. We've tried several different ways at this stage, so this is probably the best worst one. So like, for Kurt Walker in the broader scheme of things, he can come away from these games in a positive frame of mind. Obviously that disappointment of having no medal is quite unfortunate, but he's been one of the star performers across the board for Irish sport at these games, I would say.
It's just so, so hard to come back after losing the first round, as we're kind of reminded of. Like, the intricacies of amateur boxing, kind of, we all become semi-experts. I know you're always an expert, Ronan, but the rest of us become semi-experts around this time. And that's what always my in-depth analysis is, that you lose the first round, you're up against it. Who'd have thought it, considering it's one-third of the entire thing? So Kelly Harrington, Thursday morning, 6 o'clock, she'll be fighting for at least a silver medal. And it's great that it is on at 6 o'clock Irish time, because it's pretty accessible for everybody. Just want to, before we let you go, Ronan, you said you were watching the hoops earlier on at Team USA with the dulcet tones of Timmy McCarthy. The relationship between Timmy McCarthy and Kevin Durant is, well, used to be my favourite thing about Team USA, but I've now moved that on to the relationship between Timmy McCarthy and Damian Lillard as the best thing, because Timmy McCarthy has started to call him Dame Dollar every time he does something good on the basketball court, and I love it so much. McCarthy's having absolute blinder on commentary. They were playing Spain this morning. Spain, an excellent team. Ricky Rubio went off throughout the entire game, but that was pretty much all they could offer, and then in the final quarter the US pulled away. We want to see a USA-Slovenia final, Ronan. I assume you're the same.
Oh, absolutely. And Damian Lillard, it's good to see him sort of click in the exhibition games and that game against France, where he was being called Damian Lilliard by the RT country team. I think it was just the infusion of all the French pronunciations, but very much Damian Lillard turned up today, Owen. And as we both know from what our NBA watching, one of the most electric athletes on the planet. And when he's on form, like, it's something to behold. And he was good today. And yeah, I think we want to see Luka Doncic sort of on the world scene. I think there's a strong argument to be made. He's probably the best player of his age ever to play in the NBA. So we'll see how he does against Team USA. But it's been enjoyable. Timmy McCarthy gave me a good pick-me-up. It's been a scintillating morning of sport, to be fair. But just after the Kelly Harrington fight, I put RT back on and any sort of lethargy was dismissed with Timmy McCarthy. He was very chipper for whatever time of the morning that was. And like, as is his wont, he's a fantastic basketball commentator. So yeah, it's weird, the sports that coming in and out of the consciousness during the Olympic Games. I remember being enthralled by the basketball in the opening weekend, and then as the track and field came into things and the swimming and all our Irish success in rowing and so on. But then it's come very much back to the fore, and like, it's Team USA is a folklore thing in American sports. The NBA free agency window obviously opened yesterday, so it's very much a buzz basketball-wise this day it's over. So a very interesting time all around.
And if you look at the times of the final, obviously premeditated before the tournament actually began, the bronze medal game is on Saturday night at 8 o'clock Tokyo time. The gold medal game is on at 11:30 in the morning. So I wonder which market they're trying to appeal there to there. But I, for one, am greatly looking forward to Luka Doncic versus Damian Lillard / Dame Dalla on Saturday morning. It's going to be a cracker.
It's like the FA Cup, where you like to see some upsets early on in the competition, but when it gets to the finals, yeah, and it turns out it's Halifax against Bournemouth or something, you're not that interested. So it's good that Team USA are still there.
Yeah, 100%. Ronan, great stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
Ronan Mullen there with us chatting boxing, and we will be joined by Cathal Dennehy in a moment to talk athletics, because what a morning it was on the track. Just to remind you, we've got the OTB Sports Olympic show live from 5 o'clock every evening throughout the Olympics across Off the Ball. We'll be bringing you the biggest stories of the day, and we'll also take a look ahead to what is to come. It's all brought to you in association with Indeed, who are proud to support Team Ireland at the Tokyo 2020 Games. Indeed believes the world works better when people are given every opportunity to unleash their true talents. The hashtag is Talent Unleashed. We will be chatting to Cathal Dennehy in just a moment. Let me just remind you of a couple of the main stories. Actually, one of the main athletic stories this morning on the back of the Irish Independent is that McGeehan reveals training camp injury is behind woes. She had a torn calf muscle in her training camp, which obviously set her back a good bit naturally. Harry Kane is dominating a lot of the proceedings, and we'll come back to that in the papers in just a moment, as well as Royal Miners stunning the Dubs, as they put it on the back of the Irish Daily Star this morning. A great moment for the Meath Minor team yesterday. Right, we are going back to Tokyo and to Cathal Dennehy, who was there earlier on, I believe, to watch what was one of the most extraordinary finals in the history of athletics. Carson Varholm, Cathal, what an unbelievable athlete this guy is.
Yeah, I mean, he's a freak, and I mean freak in the most complimentary sense of the word. It was, I mean, you said, as you said, that I am there. It will be something I and anyone else who was lucky enough to be in the stadium would be saying for as long as we live, that we were there. Because, I mean, I've been watching sport. I'm 33, and I've been watching sport as long as I can remember, in athletics for the best part of 30 years, and I've never seen anything close to that on TV, in real life, anything. I don't think I've ever seen a sporting event. Now, I'm very biased in that sense, of course. And as I tweeted a while ago, I've been to the Nou Camp, I've seen Messi, I've been watching the Golden State Warriors and Steph Curry. And what happened this morning in Tokyo was just something, as I just wrote on the Independent website there, it's extraterrestrial, basically. And I think I think anytime, if it's cycling, if it's athletics, almost if it's any sport these days, there's always the kind of thing of suspicion. And I would say, while you can never be sure, talking to a lot of people around here, knowing the backstory of Carson Varholm and indeed the silver medalist Roy Benjamin, there's a lot of reasons to feel very good and very trustworthy, I think, in these performances. If you're going to, I guess, go into the things of explaining how he ran so fast, because we have to do that, there's two big areas to look at. And one, I think, is the super spikes, which have played an effect. Varholm worked with Mercedes to develop a carbon fiber plate in his spike plate, and also the surface is the fastest surface we've ever had. It's all athletes are saying, you know, it's like running on air, it's like kind of running on this hyper responsive surface. But then again, we've had so many athletes here running the last 5 days, and as we've seen, they're not exactly all running out of their skins, and they all have access to the same track, the same technology, but there's very, very few setting personal bests. And I mean, what we saw this morning for Varholm and silver medalist Roy Benjamin was not just running better than anyone in history. It was absolutely taking, as I said, the limits of human performance have been just sent into the stratosphere with what we watched. It was unbelievable.
Has there been any indication to what sort of percentage of performance improvement those carbon fiber plates actually provide the runner?
Well, actually, I think it's hard to know. The lower down the distances you go, the less effect they make. However, carbon fiber plates are kind of at times a misnomer, because there has been carbon plates in spikes and in running shoes for, you know, 20 years. A lot of times it works on the principle. Now, the technology has got better in recent years, but it was very interesting after the race. Varholm was, and I stood in, and Varholm was asked about spike technology, and he went on what sounded like a bit of a rant, basically. And it was so refreshing to hear, because basically Nike make their sprint spikes containing AirPods under the plate, and they also have like a layer of hyper responsive foam. And so basically what they've done, sprint spikes are traditionally just a very flat plane, a very thin hard sole, and there's nothing to them essentially. But Nike have started building up spikes up the middle distance that are thicker and more responsive. And Warholm went on a bit of a rant earlier and someone said, did the track feel like you were running on air? And he actually said, well, it didn't, but Ry Benjamin was running on air because he had that AirPods in his things. And he said, I hate them. And he said basically when we sat down, he worked with Puma, who worked with Mercedes to develop this carbon fiber plate in his spike. And he said that, they had said he wanted to be credibility in the shoe and credibility in performance. And he said, look, I get it with middle distance, long distance runners. They're out there for so long that they need cushioning under their spike. He was like, there's no reason to have a big thing under a sprint spike. And he said, it's like a trampoline. And he literally said, it's BS. And he said the actual word as well. He said, those sort of spikes are nonsense. And he said, what we built was a spike that is credible, I think. And so I think there's no doubt it is an effective spike. And no doubt it is the fastest track we've ever seen. But we've also seen the best two performances ever in his event. And I think, honestly, I think I've never seen a performance like that in athletics from Usain Bolt's world records, even going back to Carl Lewis, Haile Gebrselassie, anything. I think what we've witnessed this morning, and I suppose what most Irish people will have slept through, was the greatest athletic performance of all time.
It's the magnitude of the way he beat his own world record, Cathal. Like, I was just off the top of my head. Is it literally on Bolt's level in Berlin that the record that still stands? Is it that level of taking such a huge slice off the world record, or where does it rank on those terms?
Yeah, I mean, they do actually have, it is a whopping chunk. I mean, he took 0.76 off the world record. That equates to about 7 meters of track. So if you can imagine the very best person of all time previous to Warholm, who was Warholm himself back in June when he set the world record, he was 7 meters better today than he was. And Ry Benjamin was 6 meters better. And then the previous world record before Warholm broke it in June had stood for 29 years to Kevin Young. And the third placer today, Alisson dos Santos of Brazil, also broke that. So you had three generational talents. Obviously, the spikes and the conditions and the track played a part. But you had three of the all-time greats going head-to-head. And that's why anytime I was previewing the Olympics, people ask you about the 100 metres and the 1500 metres. I always said the two races to watch are the 400 metre hurdles. If you don't watch anything else, watch them. Because we have this so rare collection of generational talents squaring off. And I mean, it was just, it's unbelievable. I mean, there are comparison tables you can use to go across events and just say, okay, what does 45.9 equate to? And like for the 100 meters, it equates to about 960 or so. But like even one of the performances people said there on Twitter that maybe was the best Olympic final or the best race of all time was David Rudisha's 800 meter record at the London Olympics, which he ran from the front. He ran 140.91 for 800, which still stands that world record. Someone did a comparison on Warholm's time today and it equates to a 139.800, which is just like wow. a cyberspace time, you know.
That's incredible. And
I'll give you an example. He had 10 barriers to clear in that race and he ran 45.9. I think he would have beaten, the 400 meter heats were on last night here. I think he would have beaten about 12 athletes jumping 10 barriers who were in that race. And I think he only needed to run 0.3 seconds faster to make the 400 meter semifinals at the Olympics. And that's why he'll jump in 10 barriers. It's utterly out of this world. And anyone who is here in the stadium, like obviously it was an empty stadium, but we were sitting here and there was a good few, several hundred journalists and all. And everyone I met was just looking at each other going, what did we just witness? It was incredible.
Carl, can you just explain why the track is so fast in as quick a manner and as concise a manner as possible?
Don't worry, I'm not intelligent enough to explain it in any depth, but from conversations I've been having here, traditionally, Mondo tracks, Mondo is like the world leader in track manufacturing. And traditionally, the harder track, the better. Obviously, it's like bouncing a tennis ball off a wall. If you bounce it off a carpet, it doesn't bounce as far. And that was always the way. But in recent years, they've developed. So people say the track does feel slightly softer than previous iterations of Mondo tracks. But it's what it is far more responsive. And someone told me that when they do tests with it, how they test that responsiveness is essentially dropping like a metal ball, like a little marble or something. From the height of a meter and seeing once it hits the surface, how high back up does it bounce? And I was told today by someone, I suppose, in the know working involved in this, that with this track, it bounces, I think it's over 70 centimeters, which is higher than a 70% energy return. So that obviously helps. But again, if it helped that much, and if the spikes helped that much, everyone has access to these spikes now. Everyone would be running out of their skin. Everyone would be smashing the personal best. That's not happening. So that's why I think it's fair to mention all these things, but to only use it as the explanation is completely unfair, because we literally have watched the greatest race of all time.
Like, as you said, Cal, greatest race of all time. And like, to be there, this is like a Woodstock 1969, I was there kind of thing. Like, it's really, really incredible. And look, not the full capacity stadium that we would have loved to have had for a race like that. But I mean, was the atmosphere eerie during that race, considering how unbelievable it was and how the stadium wasn't as full as it should have been? Or did people forget about the empty seats for those 40 odd seconds?
I think everyone forgets, you know, they do have a bit of music going, which is good. And there's a few hundred athletes allowed. Well, there's many athletes are allowed in from other events. They can come and watch if they want. And thankfully, a good several hundred are coming and watched each athletic session. So they're down near the front. They create a bit of atmosphere. Obviously, it's nothing like it could have been. But yeah, so it is quiet. But I mean, I think we've all got so used to that now that there is enough, and they have commentary over the PA system, you know, getting excited. So I think you can still feel 60-70% of the regular energy you would feel at an athletics event when a performance is as special as that was this morning. And just, you know, I suppose the atmosphere going around, I talked to one of my friends, Phelan Kelly, who's a coach of Team Ireland. One of his athletes got through the 1500 meter heats earlier, and he and another athlete, a person I know, Gerard O'Donnell, is working as the team press attaché, and we're in a WhatsApp group, and all three of us just said that's the best thing I've ever seen. And Phelan was over on the back straight as Warholm was unfortunately walking an empty stadium lap of honour. And Phelan just leaned over the barrier, he said, and said to Warholm, "Man, that's the best thing I've ever seen." And Warholm just smiled back at him and said, "Man, it's the best thing I've ever done." And, you know, I think if you went around here and you're talking, you know, I'm talking to journalists here, some of the British guys who covered like the Euro final for them a few weeks ago, who've been to World Cup finals, who've been to everything, who were there for Bolt when he did that world record in Beijing. And pretty much all of them just can't believe, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, can't believe what they watched. They're truly just blown away by the experience of having seen that, because 46.70 was the world record before today. Warholm himself said he thought he could run 46.4, 46.5. No one ever thought anyone could run 40 under 46 seconds for it. And he said, we asked him, "What was your first reaction once you saw the clock?" And he just said, "This is sick." And I think he himself couldn't believe it. And he's a lovely guy. He is very transparent about everything. And, you know, in this sport, there are great suspicions always accompany great performances. And I would be as cynical myself about so much. But there has never been the whiff about Warholm's background, about his training group, about his coach, about his agents. There's never been an association. And normally if someone ends up testing positive or something like that, if you're around this sport and you talk to enough people and you talk to people like Thomas Barr, you know, talk to his rivals, the whispers always do go around. And I have never heard one whisper about Warholm. And that's why so many other events, when I watch astonishing performances, the thought immediately comes into your head, is it dirty? When I watched that this morning, and I think when most people in athletics and who know athletics watched that this morning, we didn't for once get that feeling, because there is a major kind of belief and a trust in Warholm. Now, whether that, I suppose time will tell whether that stands up, but I think there's a great hope in athletics at the moment and a great belief that it will.
Like the rivalry as well between Warholm and Ry Benjamin, like you mentioned the comments about not being a fan of the AirPods or lots of foam in the shoes. Another great quote from Warholm after the race, he said, he was asked about this, as you tweeted yourself, Cahal, but the possibility of a late mistake might have cost Ry Benjamin the gold. And the quote, "All credit to him, but if that mistake cost him the gold medal, he shouldn't have done it in the Olympics." Like, this is the rivalry we needed for Paris 2024, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, it's an unbelievable rivalry, and they're both genuinely lovely guys. You know, I think, like, I've gone to a good few Diamond Leagues, and like I remember a couple of years ago, Warholm was world champion. I was up getting my food at the counter, and he recognized me from another event. And normally a lot of athletes wouldn't give you the time of day, but he kind of just, I'd spoken to him once in my life, and he came over and asked me how I was traveling, all this sort of guy. And I was like, "I'm a nobody. Why are you talking to me?" And I remember another event in Boston where I was at the track filming some stuff, doing some stuff for World Athletics, doing some work. And he was going for a shuttle. And I remember Ry Benjamin walked like a few hundred meters out of his way to come over to me and just tell me that there was a car going back to the meet hotel if I wanted to join him and stuff. And I just thought, how many A-list stars in world sport would kind of I guess, be so down to earth. And I know it probably says a lot about global superstars in sport that just normal acts of human kindness are kind of the rare rather, the exception rather than the rule. But I genuinely, in Warholm and in Benjamin, you have two of the best role models you could put up for the sport on and off the track. And I think that's what's great for athletics, which is a sport that through its own deeds and misdeeds has been dragged through the mud so many times that you now have this wonderful event. And it was the same in the high jump the other night with Gianmarco Tamberi and Mutaz Essa Barshim splitting that gold medal. Again, two of the best role models, two of the loveliest, most entertaining guys you could find. And there's plenty of other names I could mention who are not nice guys in the sport and who people would be deeply suspicious of. But with Benjamin and Warholm, there is a belief that these guys are legitimate and they seem like great guys off the track as well.
Just want to touch on some of the Irish storylines before we let you go, Cathal. This morning you mentioned Andrew Coscarin there. He got through from his 1500 metre heat. Kelly Harrington was saying Hakuna Matata after her fight earlier on. I think Andrew Coscarin's best quote, talking to David Gillick afterwards, was, it's great crack, like summing up his Olympic experience. You love his confidence and his swagger. And then Phil Healy in the 400 metre finished fourth in her heat again for the second consecutive day, narrowly missing out on the next round. Are things starting to look a little bit more positive when you zoom out and look at the Irish performances overall now?
They absolutely are. I mean, we had a dire few days. You know, there's no other way around it there from Friday to, apart from the mixed relay, I'd say the Irish team had a dire few days from Friday to Monday. Lots of underperformances for various reasons. And this morning, coming to the athletics track, we didn't hold much hope for the Irish. Andrew Coscarin, like, he just about snuck in as one of the last men into the 45-man field. He's now down to the last 24. And for a guy like him, who was kind of in the doldrums, in the kind of post-collegiate, like, twilight zone of not really knowing what to do with his life and his career a few years ago, having met his coach, Phelan Kelly, and kind of come back and trained professionally and given it everything and smashed his PBs, not just to get to an Olympics, but to now be in the Olympic semi-final is a remarkable achievement. And again, he executed that race to perfection this morning. Phil Healy, your heart went out to her yesterday. You know, she walked off the track and she was utterly devastated with her performance in the 200, even though it wasn't that bad. And she said she came down to the track today and, you know, emotionally, the high of the mixed relay, she wasn't going to sleep until 4:30, 5 in the morning. You know, it was inevitable she would have been a bit flat for her individual events, but she sacrificed essentially the chance there, her best chance there, to I guess take one for the team in the relay. And she said she came down to the track and she felt, I guess, on such a downer after yesterday that they were thinking about not running. And I think Shane McCormick, her coach, had basically given her the out, said, look, let's just warm up, see how you feel. And if it's not there, let's just not go to the line. And Phil said, she said to Shane in the warm-up area, she was like, I'm not sitting in those stands. Even if I feel terrible, I'm not sitting in those stands watching and wondering what might have been. So she went out to the track and she ran the second fastest time I think she's ever run for 400 metres, finishing fourth. Unbelievable finish. And it was great to see her after being so hurt and down after walking out the track after the 200 to be able to finish her Olympics on a good note and just to say that, yeah, there's a Europeans and a World Championships next year. She could be in the European final and she can be in the World Championship semi-final. And then, yeah, our 200 metre men, just to round it out, I suppose, Leon Reid and Marcus Lawler, two really good performances. Leon is into the semi-final tonight. Didn't want to engage too much for understandable reasons about off-track issues that he's been going through, but he's very much in there now into the semi-final with the fastest run of the year. And Marcus, a guy who'd been kind of misfiring all year, he'd been running 20.9 21.0 for 200 meters best run of the year, 20.7. again, being Marcus, he's better than that, so he's not happy, but it was much better than he's been running all year, and he can hold his head up very high walking away from this.
Yeah, a couple of season bests there on the 200 meters. It's interesting that you described prior to the last couple of days as a dire Olympics up until this point, because it's always an interesting question about how much criticism the team leave themselves open to, given other than football, it is the most competitive sport in the world quite a lot over these distances. And it was interesting actually listening to Sonia on the highlight show on RT on Saturday night talking about the mixed relay, and she was making the point that Ireland should be in a position to change their starters for the final of a mixed relay, which I think Darren Maloney described it as rootless. And it is a rootless view to take such a great performance out, or one of the great performers from such a performance out, and replace him with somebody else. But it kind of spoke to me of a rootlessness in Sonny O'Sullivan's approach that maybe doesn't exist entirely in Irish athletics at the moment. That I don't want to say there's a satisfaction with certain results, but there is definitely an approach that Sonny would have had that obviously leads her to being one of Ireland's greatest ever sports people, that is kind of required if some of these Irish athletes are going to make the next step.
I fully agree with that. I mean, I remember talking to some of the other athletics journalists who've been on the beat back into the Sonia and Katrina McKiernan days, and going back to John Tracy, Eamon Coughlin. And, you know, we spoke about Sonia, and, you know, who in my mind is the greatest Irish sports person ever. And she was a cold-blooded killer, you know. Like, I know Sonia quite well, and I'd have no fear saying it. I'm sure she'd say it herself, and she's a lovely woman. But in terms of her training, her preparation, and her attitude to the sport, she was like an assassin and obsessive. And I think she was one of those, had a kind of a ruthless streak in her career when it came to performance and when it came to performing her best. And I think in Irish athletes, sometimes you do wonder sometimes if, when they come to Olympics and they're disappointed, are they asking enough hard questions of themselves and their setup in the aftermath? And you could totally understand why many wouldn't, because, you know, it's a very, like, a lot of these athletes who are going out maybe here, whether they're running their best or whether they're underperforming, don't earn basically any money from the sport. Some might get $5,000 for the year. Some might be on 12 or 20 grand off the sports council, very little private sponsorship. Most of them are still working part-time, if not full-time, for many of them. And to give everything up, and to maybe the best thing for them is to move out of Ireland to find the technical expertise. Maybe for others, it's to stay at home. But I think disappointment at a championships comes down to how you react to it. And a lot of these athletes have, you know, had disappointments here. But I guess the hope is that they will reflect and say, can I be better? And to be honest, knowing them, there's not many athletes across this Irish team. I think maybe when you go to like a European indoor championships, maybe European championships, you do have the old classic championship tourists where they're kind of just almost happy to get the kit, happy to be there. And I think sometimes but at this level, it's different. It's two tiers above a European championships. And I think all the athletes I know in the Irish team, I wouldn't say anyone in there is not reflecting extremely critically on their performance and is not asking themselves the question, because I think a lot of these athletes, you know, Phil Healy spoke about it. She changed courses. She was doing nursing in UCC and just realized that that wasn't a career path for her 20s that could, I guess, be combined with high level athletics, given the long shifts and the time on your feet. So she went in, started over and did a course in computer science. All these athletes have made decisions like that, that have, you know, athletics is the sun around which their whole world orbits. And I think when we're looking at them, maybe they're getting dumped out in the heats and maybe they're underperforming. We have to remember how much they've given to be here in the first place. And also remember that 99.9% of them do not have the talent of Sonia Sullivan and are therefore not in a privileged enough position whereby if they give up their whole lives and they move to the other side of the world, it's going to pay off for them, because, you know, for a lot of them, paying off might be making a semi-final rather than winning an Olympics and being an Irish sporting legend.
Yeah, for sure. Cathal, great insight as ever. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Thank you.
Cheers. Cathal Dennehy there, athletics writer who is based in Tokyo at the moment. Now, at 8:53 this morning, it is time to turn our attention to the weekend's Gaelic football. And Paddy Andrews was at Croke Park for Off the Ball on Sunday at the Leinster final as Dublin won their 11th provincial title in a row. Here he is on Brian Fenton and Conor Callaghan's uncharacteristically quiet performances.
The quiet performances by Conor Callaghan and Brian Fenton are probably going to come under the spotlight over the next 2 weeks before the Mayo game. 13 days now till the All-Ireland semi-final against Mayo. Why aren't they clicking, or why aren't they in flying form in a provincial final?
Look, I just think, more so than David Clifford last week with Kerry, it's, you have such high standards for these guys, particularly Fenton and Conn, two of the greatest players Dublin have ever had. So, look, a little bit quiet today, but I'd have no doubt or no worries about their form coming into the Mayo game in 13 days' time. And like I say, for Dublin as a whole, they've kind of cruised through not just the Leinster Championship, probably the whole season so far to date. They haven't really been tested or had to get out of third gear. That is definitely not going to be the case in the All-Ireland semi-final against Mayo. You've seen, I was really, really impressed with Mayo in their win over Galway. The athleticism, the energy, the running game. Dublin are going to have to up their intensity levels for that game. And look, they're so experienced. They know that themselves. And look, I think everyone's just looking forward to what should be two brilliant All-Ireland semi-finals between the four best teams.
We were speaking during the game, and in the previous 11 provincial titles that Dublin have won, they've always been favourites. Not always, but pretty much been favourites going into them over the last couple of years. Going into an All-Ireland semi-final or Super 8s or whatever way it was, it never really felt like Dublin were undercooked in any of those games. But when we're seeing the likes of Conn and maybe Fenton not hitting the heights that they previously hit before, we're seeing that uncharacteristic third quarter last week. How can Dublin use the next 13 days now to get themselves ready?
Oh, look, that's where the experience comes in. Like, even though it's Desi Farrell and Mick Galvin's only their second year in charge, a lot of those players, they've been there, they've done it, they know the crack. So over the next 13 days, it'll just be review the game today. Okay, what were the positives? There's definitely a couple of areas that they'd like to work on. But also, they know the challenge of Mayo as well. You know, they played each other so often over the last number of years, including last year's All-Ireland final. And they'll have total respect for what Mayo are going to bring to the table. We've seen it. It was the most James Horden Mayo performance from them against Galway. All action, all energy. And look, any time Dublin play Mayo, it is a bruising encounter. You're going to have it very, very physical. It puts big demands on it. And that's where guys like James McCarthy, Brian Fenton, all these fellas, their experience will come in. They'll be ready to go in 13 days' time, despite, like say, if it's perceived a little bit quieter from Fenton and Conn today. Like they know exactly what's going to be required in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, and not too concerned, Paddy Andrews there. And just to remind you, the GAA hit of 2021, the football pod with Paddy and Andy, is now available a day earlier every week, exclusively on the OTB Sports app. Tommy Rooney was up late last night recording before producing this morning's show. Episode 13 with Andy and Paddy will be released at lunchtime today as a result. So if you don't already have the OTB Sports app, go get it in your app store. It's available on all platforms from Wednesday. Anthony Moyles is now with us. Anthony, how are you getting on?
I'm good, Owen. And yourself?
Yeah, good. There seems to be two schools of thought at the moment. There seems to be, oh great, the Dubs are in third gear, we all have an opportunity. And then the other school of thought is, oh God, the Dubs are only in third gear.
Yeah. It is. I suppose it's two sides of a coin. And I don't know. I think they're probably, I'm sure Desi Farrell and his management team, and I'm sure some of the players are asking themselves as well, you know, where are we? Because there's most definitely, I think, a few worries, I think, in some of their performances. You know, I think when they look back, they'll kind of say to themselves, wow, are we really, you know, a little bit undercooked? Or are we just, is there something missing? Or are we just missing a few players that need to come back? Or is it that actually the opposition are actually closing the gap and, you know, they're just improving, you know, because I think everyone has a tendency to look at the opposition when Dublin are playing. Like, I mean, even, you know, watching the game on the weekend with Kildare, there was so much analysis of how Kildare are playing. And I suppose that's just boredom with how well Dublin have been playing over the last number of years. But I think the actual, this is the first season for a long time where people are actually analysing now how Dublin are playing and really looking at. And that's a sign in itself that I think people are saying to themselves that, oh, actually, maybe this Dublin team isn't quite hitting the levels that it was hitting over the last number of years.
And I think one of those levels is the ridiculous impact that they were getting off the bench. Like, no question that they've had the best collection of footballers we've ever seen, all the way down to number 26. And maybe that's not there at the moment. However, it's trending in the right direction for them on that front. And even just seeing someone like Owen Merchant on the bench and John Small obviously starting the other day, what that does for their options going forward is huge, Anthony, because that, I guess, activates a more advanced position for someone like Brian Howard. And starting 15-wise anyway, they're going to still be arguably the best team in the country.
Yeah, well, we spoke about this the last day, Owen, and you have a situation, obviously, where Small has come back in. You know, okay, he got a bit of a head knock and he didn't come back out, but that was no surprise. He had done enough at that stage. It was really all about testing the hamstring and seeing could he kind of stay at the pace of the game, which he did for whatever 50-odd minutes. So he's a big plus for them. Merchant coming on and adding that lightning pace, he's another big plus for them. The two of them will be obviously pushing hard for starting positions the next day, which, as you say, frees things up. Like against Meath, they didn't have their half-back line, which I think would be their preferred half-back line, which would be Robbie McDade, you know, Small and Merchant. So there's three players that you have to fill the gap. And just like Tyrone, obviously, at the weekend, when you lose an amount of defenders, you're having to pull fellas in from all over the place. Now, Howard is a good deputy, but, you know, he'd rather be in that half-forward line causing havoc. And, of course, what it does is it causes a situation, I think, where you're, as you say, you're coming into your second layer or even your third layer of players that would potentially look to come on. And it weakens any team. And I think it weakens Dublin. And then when you get a couple of fellas who are underperforming actually on the pitch, well, now you're really delving into your kind of reserves. And
you know, looking back at the game against Kildare, I just felt there was a period in that second half that if Kildare believed a bit more and had set themselves up a bit better, I think they really could have had a right good cut at Dublin because they were losing their way at around that 50-odd minute mark. And they were doing some very, very uncharacteristically non-Dublin things with the ball. Kildare didn't, and they ran out of convincing winners. But I think there was a spell there that certainly Mayo will look at and say, right, you know, if we see this again, we're certainly going to go for the jugular.
Is that something for Kildare to be disappointed about, Anthony? Because, like, as you said, they kind of left a bit out there, and a lot of spoken about Kevin Feeley's absence from midfield before the game with that knee injury. And I saw you tweeting yourself about Daniel Flynn. And look, Daniel Flynn's an extraordinarily talented forward. But as you said, can often play in spurts for Kildare. So there are a couple of worries there for them as well.
Well, I think Kildare, I read a great piece at the weekend in the Sunday Times with, you know, Johnny Doyle was mentioned in it. And it was basically just about the Kildare success that has been there over the last kind of 7-8 years underage. And Kildare have produced some massive teams at minor level and under 20 level. Now, they've got a good cohort of those players on the panel, the senior panel, but you know, it's probably a situation like some of the other counties where there's just, you know, it's not producing as many players as it possibly should do. Now, if you look at what happened on Sunday specifically with them, I felt that they set up, you know, to kind of allow themselves to still be in the game. You know, they conceded the kick out, you know, and I think if Jack O'Connor was to be very honest with themselves and the management team, they should have known, and like being from previous situations, especially when Meath have been in Leinster finals against Dublin, like you just can't do that. You have to be brave. You have to go at Dublin. You have to take a chance on their kick out. And, you know, they probably should have looked at the second half for Meath v Dublin and probably shown the level of intensity and the pressure that Meath tried to apply on Dublin and the problems that caused. And they probably should have said to themselves, listen, lads, we're going to go at this for as much as we can. Okay, they could have allowed to leave the two up top, you know, for a spell of time. And with Flynn up top, you could always just take a risk of dropping men back and allowing the ball to go in early. But once Dublin got a handle on that and dropped Johnny Cooper back in, they should have decided themselves, okay, we're going to start running the ball a bit more and start popping passes in. But you saw a spell there. I saw fellas bemoaning the fact. I think they kicked 5 or 6 bad wides in a row. But if you look at all of the shots that they took them from long distance. They weren't taking easy pot shots in around the arc. You know, they were taking kind of speculative shots. And that's because there was no one really inside. They didn't have the options inside. So it's you know, it's something, Shane, I think when they look back on it, they'll say to themselves, you know, that was a chance, an opportunity missed. Because as I said, our post the Meath game, I don't think the Dublin team, even though they had John Small back, this Dublin team are not hitting the levels that they were hitting last year or the year before. And I think if both Meath believed a bit more, and I think if Kildare believed a bit more, you know, I think they could have ran them, you know, even closer than they did.
Like one thing that stood out for me that was different about this Dublin team than, say, the Dublin teams of Jim Gavin and, as Owen said earlier, like 2017, it sort of teams, the uncharacteristic wild shooting. Like Jim Gavin had it down to a T, and we never really saw Dublin shooting from outside the, you know, the high percentage scoring zone, I guess. At the weekend, we saw quite a bit of that, and very, very uncharacteristic of the Dubs to do that. Like, is that something that Mayo will be looking at and licking their lips over, that Dublin all of a sudden are kind of shooting from places where they perhaps should not be shooting from?
Well, you know, like, I mean, it depends again, Shane, in the sense of, on one side, you could say, well, Jim Gavin's kind of rhetoric was very, very restrictive on the players. You know, it was certain people shoot and certain people shoot from only this specific area. Like, I mean, my abiding memory is Jack McCaffrey making one of those lung-busting runs from, they say, his own full back line, and he's ran like an absolute hare, and he scorches everybody, and he gets within about 10 yards of the goal, and you're thinking, stick it over the bar, put it in the back of the net, fist it over the bar, and he'd end up hand-passing it to, say, you know, Dean Rock, who'd just stick it over the bar for him. And they're kind of going, like, Jesus, you know, like, I mean, the discipline it takes to actually do that. And I remember then one occasion seeing him doing it, and he kicked, I think, with his left or right foot, and he kicked it into the goalkeeper's hands. And I remember him putting his head in his hands and thinking, you know, that'll be reviewed in the video session when I'm finished next week. So you could, you know, sometimes that's a good thing to have that restriction on players, but also sometimes it's a bad thing. sometimes it's a good thing to actually allow players to have the confidence to have a go. Like, I mean, you know, Howard came up on Sunday, I don't know if you remember this one, and he kicked one with the outside of his right boot. Now, it went wide. If it goes over, it's an inspirational score, you know, and everyone says, oh, he has that in his armory, he's such a good player. Goes wide and everyone's saying, like, what was he doing? Like, I mean, you don't usually do that. So it's a fine line, really, between allowing players to have the confidence and to believe in their own ability. And I'd say that is where there's a difference between Desi Farrell and his management team. You know, I played under Mick Galvin in St. Oliver Plunkett's, and Mick would be a type of a fella that would always say to people, listen, back yourself, have a go. You know, like, I mean, don't be afraid of taking a shot. Now, obviously, you have to have, like, I mean, certain guys on the ball. But I think that is probably a slight difference. Now, whether that's a chink that ultimately, when it comes down to a 1 or a 2 point game, that they will see and the opposition will see as, okay, here is an opportunity for us. That's yet to be seen. I know Dublin would have looked at the past, you know, kind of in certain Dublin teams that I played with or played against, should I say, and certainly people would have said, oh, the percentage rates were down in the 60s or the 70s or whatever it was of shots taken, and that there was a lot of lads taking shots from all angles. And that is one area that probably Jim Gavin really focused on. Now, whether there is a slight change and whether that allows an opportunity for the opposition, I just don't know yet. But I think shot selection is part of it, but it wouldn't be my main worry if I was on the Dublin management team. My main worry would be probably as well how some of the players are actually playing, and also I think there's a bit of a lack of movement in that full forward line. I think there's a spell there against Kildare, I don't know if you remember it, probably about the 50th to the 60th minute, 55 minutes, where Dublin were really all over the place. And they were just very, very stagnant. There was a lot of frantic stuff going out around midfield, but the inside full forward line were just basically holding their positions. Dean Rock was way out, you know, underneath the kind of Cusick stand, wasn't really looking to get involved. Costello wasn't moving. Con O'Callaghan was very, very quiet. And Kilkenny was really the only one who was kind of buzzing around. And Kildare were very comfortable. And Kildare probably should have tried to turn them over, and they did a couple of times, but they just didn't convert into scores. That would be a worry for them again, playing against the likes of Mayo.
Shane, in our YouTube comments, has been in touch. He said, ah, lads, can OTB stop this with the Meath performance versus Dublin? Wow, 20 good minutes against a team in second gear. It's getting annoying at this stage. But is the point not that they only played well for 20 minutes? Because they're, as you say, chickened out of pressing up in the kick-out, and they still got within single digits of a team going for 7 in a row. Is that not the very point here?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is the point. You know, exactly. Like, I mean, you know, Mayo will not play for 20 minutes. You know,
exactly.
Mayo will come with everything they have. Like, I think it's probably fair to say there's a hatred between Mayo and Dublin. Like, these guys do not like each other. These guys have played against each other the last number of years. And I think Dublin it'll probably give Dublin a kick. I think of all the other three, this is a game that Dublin really need, because they need a good, tough, hard game against a rival that they see as, we want to keep the foot literally pinned on top of their head. Mayo will see this. Horan would see this as an enormous opportunity to get one over them, and an enormous opportunity to obviously get into the All-Ireland final. So this, like, you know, we're trying to analyse Dublin in the sense of the high levels that they've been at, the fact that they've been beaten, you know, Leinster teams by 15 plus points, and now the fact that actually, you know, that is now coming into the single digits. You know, whether it's low single digits or high single digits, it doesn't matter. There still means that there's a convergence. Now, is it, as I said, that the other teams are getting better, or is it that the Dublin's coming back a bit? I think it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
But regardless of what you're doing in Leinster, like, I mean, this is where you start to get paid. This is the big money games. And when you come in against Mayo, who had that second half, and imagine how they feel after that second half. Totally underperformed first half, lack of intensity, lack of drive, lack of desire. Second half, absolutely, completely changed, you know, and just blew Galway out of the water. They're full of pomp, and they will have an X on Dublin's back, and they will have seen enough evidence over the last number of weeks to think, yeah, this is an opportunity for us. This is not the same Dublin team of the last number of years, and we can take them.
Anthony, just to touch on the Ulster final at on Saturday afternoon as well. And look, I was watching the Sunday game on Sunday, and they were kind of talking about Monaghan maybe giving Tyrone too much respect in the first half. Look, as a Monaghan person, I'm going to find it very hard to criticise the teams after the couple of weeks that have happened. And look, I was at the under-20 game on Friday night in Armagh, and the senior game as well on Saturday. And there has obviously been that dark cloud of Ogie Duffy's passing over Monaghan football recently. So it's hard to kind of look at it from just a footballing perspective, given what's happened over the last couple of weeks. But if you were to say one thing about Saturday and about the last number of weeks in Ulster, it's fair to say the Ulster Football Championship is alive and well.
Well, you know, two things on that, obviously, Shane. Like, I mean, yes, absolutely, it is hard to look beyond, you know, just football, but I suppose that's what we'll try to do here. You know, it's been a shocking couple of weeks, very, very difficult for everyone involved, absolutely. And very difficult to ask teams to go out and play, especially the first game against Armagh, you know, in such a short space of time, and obviously the situation and the feelings in the gales of Monaghan. I thought they show a lack of, did they give them too much respect? I don't think so. I think they stood off a bit. I don't think they were aggressive enough, you know, in the first half. They allowed Tyrone have the ball and play it around in certain points out around the certainly the middle kind of third of the Croke Park. They didn't push up. They weren't enough in their face. And, you know, they changed that second half. And a massive change for them in the second half was Began coming out and filling that area out to Morgan's left-hand side with his kickouts. Like, I mean, Began is a big, big man. He's 6'3", 6'4". Obviously, the colour of the jersey, because he's wearing the goalkeeper's jersey. If you look up as a goalkeeper and you're trying to scan the pitch, and all of a sudden you see this big, big, massive man wearing a different colour jersey to everyone else, your eyes are attracted to it. You know, and all of a sudden you're saying to yourself, well, I can't kick over there. That's a no-no. And the fact is that, listen, we've spoken about it loads of times. Began is so adept on the ball. Like, I mean, he's not like your traditional keeper where he's just going to get it and hand pass it off. He can come, he can spray a pass, which he did on Sunday. You know, he's very confident even coming into a tackle with a player. So, you know, if you kick to him, he's going to catch it and he's going to punish you. So essentially now a third of your field is now gone. So you're now looking down the middle or you're looking out to your right. And that pressure that they applied was unbelievable. And it really put Tyrone under an enormous amount of pressure. Tyrone didn't know where to go. Tyrone were fumbling the ball. They were running into tackles. They actually got really, really out of sorts. Tyrone would usually kill the game at that stage if there were 4 or 5 points up, tried to suck the life out of it. But instead, they got into, you know, we've been talking a lot about boxing this morning, but they got into basically just a fight where they were just slugging with Monaghan, giving the ball away, getting it back, giving the ball away. And, you know, Monaghan did really, really well. They'd be sick that they had a couple of chances in those last few minutes. Just the wrong fellas got the ball, took pot shots, like the two or three chances when they were a point behind to level it, you know, and then actually I think it was McKenna who got the ball, tried very un-Tyrone thing, tried to kind of hook this ball out over the top of a Monaghan player. They got one more opportunity. They lost it down on the Cusick stand side, and they never got the ball back then. So, but look, they can be massively proud, Shane, of what they've done. Some people were on to me saying I didn't give them enough credit after the Armagh game. And I thought Armagh, to be honest with you, really would kick themselves after that game. And it wouldn't have surprised me if Monaghan had lost. I think a lot of people would have said, well, how could they have won that game considering the events leading up to it? I thought they were unbelievable. And resilience is thrown around, and it's been thrown around a lot about certain things. But the resilience of those players and the resilience of everyone involved has been unbelievable in the last couple of weeks. And fair play to them. They've got a serious team, and they'll come back. I think Tyrone missing those few players really took a toll on them. And whereas it took a toll, it didn't necessarily take a toll on the starting 15, but going back to Owen's point about the bench, it took a toll of what they could bring in. If you again look at what they did for Donegal, they brought fellas in from the bench who not only kind of just kept the level going, but they raised the bar. And I think they got something like 1-2 or 1-3 off the bench that day. And really, with those guys missing from the start, you know, that element of bringing on some fellas who can really up the ante and who can change the game for you and give you a different kind of tactical view, that was lost. So I think Tyrone will be better for it. Are they good enough to beat Kerry? I don't think so.
Right, we will get your thoughts on all of that before the semi-finals roll around, though. But great stuff this morning, Anthony.
Cheers, lads.
Anthony Moyles there, former Meath captain, on the line with us, reacting to the Leinster football final and the Ulster football final as well. Right, just to tell you what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. We've got OTB Goals from 1 o'clock with Ronnie Delaney. Then there is, from 3 o'clock, the Dadcast coming your way, a career retrospective interview with Stephen Elliott coming up at 4 o'clock. And then from 6 p.m, Jerry Eisenberg talking about Muhammad Ali from 7 o'clock then tonight. I should say, in the middle of all that, by the way, is at 5 o'clock is the Olympic show, which is on every single day during the Olympics, with thanks to Indeed. 7 o'clock on your radio and on the OTB Sports app tonight. Off the Ball is live. Right, at 9:15 on this Tuesday morning, we're going to take a quick break, but we are reflecting on the win for South Africa in the second test of the British and Irish Lions tour with Fiona Hayes next.
OTB AM.
Alright, so finished South Africa 27, the British and Irish Lions 9 in their second test on Saturday afternoon. To look back on this, delighted to welcome Fiona Hayes back to the show. Fiona, good morning to you.
How are you getting on?
Yeah,
great to be here.
Good stuff. So, Saturday, why did we see, scoreline-wise, such a comprehensive win for the Springboks?
For me, to be honest, the thing that disappointed me most about the game was the lack of ambition in backline attack in general with the Lions team. I mean, there were times in the first half, in the first maybe 20 minutes, when we had the South Africans under the pump, maybe 5, 6, 7 meters out, 10 meters out, and then when we got our penalties, we seemed to go for the post, which some people might agree with, but I think we really had them physically in those open 20 minutes. And we didn't go for it. We didn't take those chances and back our line out or scrum to go over and get us a try. And it was just that kind of lack of ambition in general for the whole game that really disappointed me. I think a lot of talk about Harris in the centre at 13. Looking back in the game, I think he had 3 carries with ball in hand with 0 meters gained. For a 13, that's really unheard of in a game of rugby.
That's interesting, because it seems that the immediate scapegoats after the game, Fiona, were the back three. But from what you're saying there, the entire back line is to blame.
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of at times I was kind of disappointed with Biggers. I mean, we looked at Andre Pollard. He literally pulled all the tricks out of the bag at times. He's kicking for the 2 tries. His grubber was absolutely excellent. And that was execution, but he also tried these things throughout the game. And I think maybe Bigger was a little bit too conservative for me when looking at the game.
That's interesting. So when it comes to Dan Biggar then, and you were having a conversation with him during the week, is it just a suggestion to be brave? Because in one way, Fiona, I can kind of see why you'd go for 3, because it seemed the first day out, every penalty was worth its weight in gold. I don't think too many people expected, especially even at halftime on Saturday, to see those South African wingers get activated and to score a couple of tries they did in really fluid fashion. You know, that like when you go in at half time with 9 points on the board, you start to think to yourself, that's an all right scoreline. Clock that up again in the second half and you might have a winning score.
Yeah, I just think like going into it, I mean, they played exactly similarly to how they played in the first test. You're not going to go out and meet a South African team that you're going to do the exact same thing to run over 2 weeks in a row. You know what I mean? I know there was a game plan there and they stuck to that. But tactically, I'd like to see that changed up. For me, when Biggar hit the post and, you know, I think in the second half from that penalty, from there, that's when I started to see a shift in how the Springboks played. And even after that first try, when that first try went in, I thought we'd kind of start maybe trying things out, really putting the pressure back line attack wise, getting the ball wide, and we just didn't see that. I know a lot of people talked about how poor the back three were, and they certainly were at times. I mean, there was 11 air duel battles, and I think in the second half alone they lost 9 of them, which isn't really a great statistic. And I know, like, you might look back and you'd look at the video footage and you analyze that, and maybe that mightn't have happened the week before, and it's just a tiny little margin of errors. But for me, they were just so conservative, even when they were going down points and the scoreline was drifting away from them.
It like that aerial battle is really interesting, Fiona. Like, and he brought it up there. They got hammered in that department. And like, can that just happen to a team if you are sent out to play conservatively? That when it comes to those one-to-one battles in midair. The opposition are just more up for it. They've got a more aggressive game plan, and you're sort of, not defeatist attitude, but something resembling that actually drips down all the way into those one-to-one battles, and you start to lose them.
That's exactly it. It's a mentality game that starts to become after you lose one or two, and they keep and we saw the Springboks then decided let's go for it, let's put the foot in the juggler. But it wasn't even those duel battles. If you saw the line speed of the chasers in general across the pitch, even if they didn't get the ball, there was one time I was watching, and Willie LaRue who had an absolutely magical game, put an up and under, and he slipped halfway through the kick. It was actually the chase of the pack, the whole South African team, to put the pressure on, that they absolutely gained yards. And in that first phase, they obviously didn't get the ball back. It went too long, but it was the line speed had them up on the 22. And then that's when the error kicked in for the Lions. So it's even just across the board, their mentality, their work rate, their want to win that ball just heightened with every time the Lions lost one of those battles in the air.
You're listening to Fiona Hayes talking about the second test of the British and Irish Lions. Just to remind you that we will have live radio commentary of the Lions' decisive third and final test against the Springboks this Saturday. Brian O'Driscoll and Keith Wood were on duty for us last weekend, and you can hear all of that analysis and reaction in the OTB Rugby podcast channel or Off the Ball on YouTube. Our Lions coverage brought to you in association with Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. So Fiona, what did we see differently from South Africa? Why did we see a more incisive version of their attack?
Attacking wise, I think they were just very, very, very clinical at times. And, you know, I spoke about obviously Pollard trying different things, but in general, it was kind of when they had advantage for penalties that they tried these things, and they literally up to that, their line speed was much more aggressive. Their want in the second half, but in the backline attack, I think the hands were clinical. It just had an outstanding game. You know, he hasn't been talked up a lot, I don't think, in the media, but just watching him and D'Alande in the centres are really, really clicking. And I think that's magic, or that's what's happening in being able to get that ball wide. And Willie LaRue as well coming into that line of attack. They just looked far more creative, but also very clinical in that creativity.
Fiona, when you look at that South African bench even as well, and the strength and depth, like, of course the Lions squad is strong in its own right, but I'm just looking at the guys who came off the bench for the Springboks the weekend. You have Dieger, unbelievable when he came on in the 55th minute. Trevor Nyakane came off the bench as well. Like, and those subs for South Africa made a huge difference. Like, are you looking at this Lions team and maybe, I guess, questioning their strength and depth in comparison with the Springboks?
Yeah, and it's a Lions team. We shouldn't even be questioning that, because you're dealing with like players from a few nations that are there that have played games together. Now they've had a good few games together that should be chomping at the bit to come on. I know there's a lot of talk about that South African bomb squad, and I mean, it was the changing of the games at the time, but for me, it was the set pieces where the Lions were kind of let down. And that front row coming off and seeing in the last 10 minutes again, like, international front rows, you know, shouldn't be getting walked back 5 metres in a scrum. And that just happened. They literally tore the scrum apart when the changes were made. And that really shocked me. And you spoke about Lou Dieger. He just came on and dominated that line out, and his physicality around the pitch. It was strange for me to see. I know he has played in the past for them to take Visa off and put Mustard in the back row. I was wondering, okay, what are they going for? But it obviously really, really worked in that CP, in that set piece area for them. But it also worked in carries around the pitch. They were getting gain line. They were just working really hard for one another.
Like, we know Rassie Erasmus has kind of created this us versus the world thing with the Springboks. But there was, I think it was Warren Gatlander, certainly one of the Lions, talking after the match of the weekend. And he says, this is going to be a wounded Lions team now heading into the final test. And they've taken a dent, and they need to put that right. Like, are you expecting a bit of a backlash from the Lions this weekend?
I'm expecting a bit of a backlash, but I don't know where they're exactly going to bring that. I mean, they physically were, when I looked at the start of this game, the first 10 minutes, I really, really was blown away by how dominant the lines were, how physical they came out. They were ready to go. I was expecting, now it was an absolute battle of a match, but it just seemed to fade. And when they weren't getting gain line with their carries, it was like they didn't know where to go with the ball. I'm just wondering, what have they a plan B? Are they going to come out and play a similar style of rugby? There was a lot of kicking. Even when they were losing those aerial battles, they still kept with that kicking. So I suppose if we can see a different change in tactics, you know, our South Africa, we know what they can bring. They bring that physical strength, but they've also polished off backline moves. Their wingers, their back three are firing now. So for me, if the Lions stick to the same game plan they have in the last two games, I think South Africa will easily deal with that. So if we can change it up and maybe bring in, you know, as we said earlier, a lot of talk about the back three, I think there definitely needs to be a shake up there, and maybe a couple in the pack as well. It's possible, but I think tactically there needs to be a change by Gatland.
Will Rassie Erasmus be thinking, my master plan worked?
He's big long video. Yeah. I would say so. I mean, he took the pressures, you know, it's like a Jose thing to Mourinho thing to do. He took the pressures off the players, everybody, media, everyone was talking about this hour and 4 minute long video or however long it was. You know, I'm sure you've discussed it already. It wasn't great for the game, but obviously his side came out, there was less pressure in them, they were able to just focus. Referees, I thought the referees were good, or ref was good at the weekend, but there was a few 50-50 decisions that actually went South Africa's way, so you can say that he did have a slight influence, and it worked for his team and definitely in their favour.
The TMOs, let's just say they took their time when it came to their decision. And like, I mean, it's no surprise whatsoever when you've been under the microscope for that long. But like, I mean, it's not the top line here. I mean, the performance from the Lions is definitely the top line. But like, yeah, is the subtext here a little bit about what, like, this is still a little bit of an exhibition for Rugby Union. It is the biggest event every 4 years. And what we have here is a 2-hour and 15-minute game or something like that. The first half of which was pretty disappointing, fair. Like, is that something that disappointed you at all, just in terms of what it does for rugby, or the lack of what it does for rugby?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't like it at all. I watched it. I'm a big Rassie Erasmus fan. With Munster, everything. He's an amazing coach. But this mind game that's creeping in between, let's put something in the back of the head of the officials. I know it's been part of the game of years, but to come out and verbally talk about, show 36 clips, show all the errors that you thought Nick Berry made. You mean, I don't like that in the game. I read an article there yesterday that the All Blacks are now even coming, not, you know, they're obviously always going to say a few things, but they literally, I think Ian Foster said, the head coach said that it was, he's bored alive by watching South Africa, that he had to turn off the game. Like, so they've already started, you know, these mind games for the Rugby Championship, and it just seems like it's kind of going that way. And, you know, I think the talking should be done on the pitch and with officiating. I mean, any coach, any player, you can go back and look at a game and every nearly 90, maybe 80% of the calls could be changed either way, especially at the breakdown, because it's tiny margins. And to now start analysing that, I think it's really taken the game in a dangerous direction.
Yeah, for sure. Just then on some of the changes that you've mentioned there, you said positionally what you think should change. So personnel-wise, who do you see coming into the team? Who do you see dropping out?
Yeah, I definitely think in his column I was reading, Gatland, I definitely think he's going to bring Liam Williams in. I mean, Hogg had a very, very poor game, I thought. He looked at times disinterested, which I couldn't understand. He spoke that Liam Williams was very, very disappointed to not be there. So I'd imagine he's chomping at the bit to get out there. So I think they're looking at, you might get Josh Adams in there as well. Whether he goes with Watson or Van der Merwe, I don't think he'll change all back three. He'll definitely change two out of three, I would imagine. I'm not too sure about the pack. They played individually good at times, but obviously gain line carries was a big thing. I'd love to see Henderson or Tadhg Byrne in there. Whether he will make those changes, I'm not too sure. And I suppose everyone's talking about that Ali Price, Conor Murray kind of battle. But for me, Ali Price didn't come on and do anything differently. So there's obviously a game plan there, and both nines are just playing what they're being told to.
How do you rediscover that aggression in the space of a week? Because your analysis there is fairly damning, and a lot of people agree with you, Fiona. It'll just be interesting to see how you can actually turn that around in the space of a week. And maybe aggression is actually the wrong word. It's like a street smart to the analysis as well, where you're talking about them kicking and yes, leading to losing possession, and they kept on kicking. And it just seems, if Ireland were doing that, we'd be hammering them. If Munster were doing that, we'd be hammering them. And it just seems that at the very pinnacle of Northern Hemisphere rugby, this is also what's happening.
Yeah, exactly that. I suppose you're not in that coaching setup. You don't know. Obviously, there's game plans involved, but it would be nice to see the players on the pitch, you know, if things aren't going right, changing that up themselves. As I spoke about Chris Harris earlier with the three carries and no meters gain. He's a 13. Maybe he should be telling bigger, I want to carry more, changing up the calls. You know, you want people to dominate that, but you also want people to get involved. And I found at times people kind of were hiding and staying outside and not getting involved. Definitely physicality was big at times. So I don't think they'll be looking at, you know, questioning their aggression. It's just exactly what you said, that street smarts and maybe a couple of penalties they gave away at the breakdown were quite naive at times, and definitely need to sort out a set piece, especially in the second half. If you're bringing on a completely new front row, they need to be getting in there firing, and they need to be able to control, because we saw at times that's where the South Africans do damage, is off that set piece play.
For sure. It's going to be a really interesting build up now to the third and final test. Fiona, great stuff this morning. Thanks a million.
No worries. Thanks, guys. Hopefully a Lions win now.
Hopefully. Fiona Hayes there with us analysing the second test defeat to the Springboks. Right, I just want to say congratulations to Paul Colligan, who wanted the Waterford Hurlers in green. Criminally underrated, he said. Paul, you've won a Gillette starter pack, and we'll give you all another chance to win next Monday as well here on OTBAM. A couple of other suggestions for our performance rankings. James Breton, he mentioned the Meath Miners in green for another Leinster title. P. Foy on Instagram said, stick the Offaly under-20s in green. Absolutely sensational on Saturday. Chill, 1608 once. Gatland and Celtic in red, while Brian Rossiter said, put Daniel Levy in red. OTBAM brought to you live every morning by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now you can join us again from 7:30 tomorrow morning. Nathan Murphy is going to be co-hosting. We'll be talking hurling ahead of the All-Ireland semi-finals and the latest with the Lions and much more besides.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.